Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Hello, Emily.
Hello. You're just in time for tea.
Thank you.
You brought me some chocolates.
2 boxes of Hershey's.
Well, that's very American of you, Charlie. You just had to bring along some small token of opulence. Well, I don't want them. You Yanks can't even show affection without buying something.
Well, don't get into a state over it. I just thought you liked chocolate.
I do. But my country's at war, and we're doing without chocolates for a while. And I don't want oranges or eggs or snowflakes either. Don't show me how profitable it'll be to fall in love with you, Charlie. Don't Americanize me. That's my father. He lost a leg in the First War. Got the Victoria Cross for that. He died at an air raid a week after that portrait was painted. That's my brother there. His name was Charlie too, by the way. He was shot down during the Blitz. Sacrificed himself to save his squadron. And the one you're looking at now is my husband.
He looks like a rake.
Yes, he was very bawdy. I was insane about him. He died at Tobruk. The rest of the lot there are cousins. There's 2 of them still living. I must say the family's been thinned out nicely one way and another. Charlie, before we go out to my mum, I must tell you, well, she's a bit mad. Oh, you'll like her very much. She's very funny. But she may just yatter away about my father and my brother as though they were still alive. Well, just go along with her. Do you understand?
Oh, I understand. You don't want my Hershey bars.
Mm-hmm. I think it profane to enjoy this war.
You know, I never realized what a sensual satisfaction grieving is for women.
I'm not sure that's a very tasteful thing for you to say.
I'm not sentimental about war. I see nothing noble in widows.
You're jealous of my husband. I like that. Mother.
Oh, you brought chocolates, 2 whole boxfuls. What a treasure trove.
I already refused them, Mother.
On aesthetic grounds.
Oh, you're an absolute flatulent, Emily.
Oh, take the things if you want them.
Well, I shall have one later and save the rest for your father. I take it you're Emily's new lover, since she hasn't bothered to introduce us.
You must be her mother.
Ah, you found the chink in my armor. What are your religious views?
I'm a practicing coward.
That's very fervent of you.
Oh, I should have known you two would get on. You're as dotty as she is, Charlie.
Actually, before the war, I was an assistant night manager of a diplomatic hotel in Washington, D.C.
What made you say that?
Oh, Lord, I'm beginning to feel like Alice at the tea party.
Shh. He's going to tell us about a religious experience, I think.
Yes. It was my job as assistant night manager to arrange things for many of the great historical figures who came to Washington on great historical missions.
What exactly did you arrange?
Usually I arranged girls, but individual tastes varied, of course.
Of course.
Well, it's useful work anyway, especially in a war. I was offered all sorts of commissions in the Army and Navy. The one I have now, in fact. Admiral Jessup phoned me to join his staff. But I'd always been a little embarrassed by my job at the hotel, and I wanted to do something redeeming. Have you noticed that war is the only chance a man gets to do something redeeming? That's why war is so attractive.
War's very handsome, I agree.
At any rate, I turned down Admiral Jessup's offer, and I enlisted in the Marines as a private. I even applied for combat service. My wife, to all appearances a perfectly sensible woman, encouraged me in this idiotic decision. 7 months later, I found myself invading the Solomon Islands. There I was, splashing away in the shoals of Guadalcanal. It suddenly occurred to me a man could get killed doing this kind of thing. Fact is, most of the men splashing along with me were screaming in agony and dying like flies. Those were brave men dying there. Peacetime, they'd all been normal, decent cowards. Frightened of their wives, trembling before their bosses, terrified at the passing of the years. But war had made them gallant. They had been greedy men. Now they were self-sacrificing. They had been selfish. Now they were generous. You know, war isn't hell at all. It's man at his best. The highest morality he's capable of.
Never mind all that. What's this about a wife?
That night, I sat in the jungles of Guadalcanal, waiting to be killed, sopping wet. It was then I had my blinding revelation.
Ah.
I discovered I was a coward. That's my new religion. I'm a big believer in it. Cowardice will save the world. It's not war that's insane, you see. It's the morality of it. It's not greed and ambition that makes wars. It's goodness. Wars are always fought for the best of reasons, for liberation or manifest destiny. Always against tyranny and always in the interest of humanity. So far this war, we've managed to butcher some 10 million humans in the interest of humanity. Next war, it seems we'll have to destroy all of man in order to preserve his damn dignity. Not war that's unnatural to us. It's virtue. As long as valor remains a virtue, we shall have soldiers. So, I preach cowardice. Through cowardice, we shall all be saved.
That was exalting, Commander. Absolutely occult.
Yes, well, never mind the metaphysics, Commander. Let's get back to your wife.
Well, needless to say, that first night I wrote Admiral Jessup, saying in essence, for heaven's sakes, get me out of this. 2 weeks later, I was transferred back to Washington. I raced home to my wife.
And found her with another man.
Oh, Lord, no. Now, my wife, who had deceived me more times before the war than I care to think about, was now having a time of her life being faithful. She was furious with me for coming back. There was no reason for her being virtuous anymore. She promptly sued me for divorce on the grounds of religious differences. I was a self-preservationist, you see, and she was a high Anglican sentimentalist.
Well, you're fair game, then.
After every war, you know, we always find out how unnecessary it was. And after this one, I'm sure all the generals will dash off and write books about the blunders made by other generals, and statesmen will publish their secret diaries, and it'll show, beyond any shadow of doubt, that war could easily have been avoided in the first place. And the rest of us, of course, will be left with the job of bandaging the wounded and burying the dead.
I don't trust people who make bitter reflections about war, Mrs. Barham. It's always the generals with the bloodiest records who are the first to shout what a hell it is. It's always the war widows who lead the Memorial Day parades.
That was unkind, Charlie, and very rude.
We shall never end wars, Mrs. Barham, by blaming it on ministers and generals or warmongering imperialists or all the other banal bogeys. It's the rest of us who build statues to those generals and name boulevards after those ministers. The rest of us who make heroes of our dead and shrines of our battlefields. We wear our widow's weeds like nuns, Mrs. Barham, and perpetuate war by exalting its sacrifices. My brother died at Anzio.
I didn't know that, Charlie.
Yes, an everyday soldier's death, no special heroism involved. They buried what pieces they found of him. But my mother and Sissy died a brave death and pretends to be very proud.
You're very hard on your mother. Seems a harmless enough pretense to me.
No, Mrs. Barham. Now, you see, now my other brother can't wait to reach enlistment age. That'll be in September.
Oh, Lord.
Maybe ministers and generals who blunder us into wars, Mrs. Barham. The least the rest of us can do is to resist honoring the institution. What has my mother got for pretending bravery was admirable? She's under constant sedation and terrified she may wake up one morning, find her last son has run off to be brave. I don't think I was rude or unkind before, do you, Mrs. Barham?
No. You better push off, Emily, if you've got to get to work.
Give my best to Father, then.
Your father died in the Blitz, and your brother died a brave and pointless death in December 1940. I've carried on much too long with all this as it is.
Oh, no, do go. Honestly, I'd much rather be alone. Really, I mean it. I mean it. You're a kind man, Commander. I hope you'll come again.
Thank you, ma'am. I'd like to.
Peaceful solution called Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it. So let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it and get ready to receive it.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. If you're a new listener, this podcast acts as a virtual classroom for adults designed to point out and provide useful perspectives, resources, and information. Each episode contains a subject of study essential to a comprehensive understanding of reality, all of which is focused on providing you with the history, context, references, and the various methods and tools so that you can learn for yourself that which public schools cannot afford to provide. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial-free and presented free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers to the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community and learn how to apply this journey of discovery to your everyday life. If after studying the episode notes you're looking to learn more, Peace Revolution also has several partner podcasts which likewise feature commercial-free educational podcasts free to the public, including CorbettReport.com, GnosticMedia.com, MediaMonarchy.com, RemedyRadio.com, and many others, each of which uniquely fills the void left by public schooling and mainstream media. And now for a very special announcement for those of you listening to this episode in near real time. We're about to wrap up post-production on The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. And while this won't be your last chance to get the discount available only to Peace Revolution listeners, it will be your last chance to have your name appear in the end credits of this landmark of American history, listed as an associate producer for this project. Now, while that might sound like a good idea, let me explain why it's a brilliant idea. Picture this. You've screened your copy of The Ultimate History Lesson, and now you'd like to share it and give others a chance to recover their birthright as human beings. But most people won't make the time, invest the effort, or focus their mind, as you've learned to do over these episodes. And there's the rub, as Shakespeare would say. The information in this project won't move forward until you can help others break out of their own limited perspectives. And here's the part which makes it brilliant. Most people are also entrained by our status quo to give their attention to people they perceive to be leaders, taking decisive actions, people who produce results. Enter you as one of the associate producers of this project, whereby your initiative, foresight, and credit for your contribution are now momentous enough to help someone else realize this gift of wisdom that is the ultimate history lesson. And while it might seem like your family and friends should consider your thoughts, opinions, and research seriously, you and I both know that those who are entrained to the entertainment of the establishment need all the help they can get to re-engage their mental gears and start thinking for themselves. And you, as an associate producer, can help make that happen. And of course, if you've already donated to help us get through this post-production period, you have already been granted this title. So please let me know only if you do not desire for your first and last name to be aired in the end credits. Last but not least, it's not my intention to attach status to your accreditation as an associate producer. Rather, I'm merely using the pre-existing forces which reside in the minds of those who are conditioned by the public school system, employing it as a lever to help them lift themselves up and out of that mentality. And maybe, just maybe, somewhere in the future, they're listening to this and realizing why you became an associate producer on this project in the first place. After all, love is all that exists in this world when you learn how to remove the fear, one mind at a time. And that is the lesson that we all have to learn for ourselves in our own time. Anyone who donates $50 or more to the completion of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, before November 5th, 2011, will be entitled, literally and figuratively, to refer to themselves as an associate producer of this project, and leverage the fact that your help enabled us to offer millions of people the first real opportunity to improve their lives. And to that end, this is the third installment of a very special interview episode of Peace Revolution featuring the gentle tone, scholarly insights, and wealth of wisdom that combines in the form of John Taylor Gatto, the legendary educator, author, and icon of liberty who offers a lifetime of perspectives on the origins, intentions, and destiny of the compulsory public school system. The audio for this episode was taken from the third hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, with historical context and commentary provided by Kevin Cole, Paul Verge, Jan Irvin, Tony Myers, and Lisa Arborcheski. This is a comprehensive interview session which memorializes John's life's work and embodies our birthright as human beings. Truly an event which is relevant and relative to each and every one of us. But before we begin this episode, let me explain why, during the introduction to this third hour, I invested several minutes into building out the context of what this journey means to us in comprehensive reality. I played a few minutes from a film starring James Garner and Julie Andrews entitled The Americanization of Emily, which is a 1964 American comedy drama war film. Yes, there is such a thing, apparently. And in this case, it was written by Patty Chayefsky and directed by Arthur Hiller. Interestingly enough, not only is Patty Chayefsky one of my favorite writers, but he's also the only person to have won 3 solo Academy Awards for Best Screenplay. Among his film credits are The Hospital, a brilliant satire on the healthcare system, Altered States, a journey into the world of academic psychedelics, and last but not least, Network, one of the finest films to comment on the hypocrisy of the corporate mass media as juxtaposed to the news establishment. I included this sample from The Americanization of Emily as it provides a jolting perspective, which is quite useful in learning how to start thinking courageously about war and why we fight in order to prop up egos and international economies. I'll also mention that the screenplay's theme of cowardice as a virtue has no parallel in the pre-existing novel. In fact, the novel doesn't mention cowardice at all. Everything you heard in that sample was from the mind of Patty Chayefsky, and I think it helps to introduce the ideas embedded throughout today's episode, as those are the ideas which form the root cause of war, noting that American bravery in the past 150 years has historically been a consequence of mass propaganda to dehumanize other human beings, predicated on their geolocation or religious beliefs. The screenplay implies, but never explicitly explains, what is meant by the term Americanization, but in fact, the novel uses Americanized to refer to a woman who accepts, as a normal condition of wartime, the exchange of her sexual favors for gifts of rare wartime commodities. And the irony is, it's been over 40 years, and yet the Americanization of the world continues, for now. In order to stop history from endlessly repeating, we must first learn how to know ourselves through knowing our history, and this is yet another successive step leading in the right direction. This is episode 43, The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, Hour 3, plus commentary. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Sound?
One here. Yep.
All right.
Here. One here.
I'm going to slate. It's a day with John Taylor Gatto, roll 3. Start with dropping my handkerchief. When we left off, we were talking about how the committees were investigating the foundations. So there was a Cox committee, there was a Rees committee, they were looking into the origins of the education system and what, you know, and what is it really doing versus what do people need to survive and thrive in this world? And they discovered there was a more than a crevasse, more than a Grand Canyon. There was a gap between what we need to survive and thrive and be successful entrepreneurs pursuing the American dream with a real hope of attaining it versus being a servile class. And these committees kind of snapshotted and said that there's some foundations and there's some things in action and they're trying to evoke real change and they're going after our children.
They were puzzled because they detected an agenda, but they couldn't figure the agenda out. And with the second commission, the Rees, a firestorm broke loose. In fact, Rees was never able to finish thanks to the chief counsel. Was that Cox?
The chief counsel, well, I know there was a lawyer involved with the Rees committee, Catherine Casey, who was the lawyer sent by Norman Dodd to go into the archives of the Carnegie Foundation. Yeah. And after being brought up in a traditional, you know, status quo education, she went there and saw the actual minutes and the words of these men in these meetings planning on how to take over this country and to take over the diplomacy and power of war.
Was Dodd the chief counsel for Rees?
Dodd was the chief researcher, and he was out of J.P. Morgan earlier, and he had said, you guys need to return to sound banking, and they said, Norm, we're going to let you go. And then Carol Rees had called him up and said, Norm, we want you to head up research because we think what they were describing is communist activity from my research, like in the comprehensive
sense.
Well,
they didn't see clear. That was the bêtement of the moment, and so that was the easiest way to organize, but it was something far, far more profound than communism. Yes.
Right. So that gets back into Pestalozzi, Lavater, other people who were intellectual elites who joined clubs. It's like the Bavarian Illuminati was one such club that has a lot of the intellectual elite of the area getting together, and in their drawing rooms, they're drawing out the plans for other people's lives. And they basically, when you look at the origins of our education system in America, it goes directly back to Adam Weishaupt's plans, which, you know, are planned on earlier plans, but still there is an organized effort to go after our education system.
Well, there's one more recent than that. There was the Metaphysical Club at Harvard right around the turn of the 20th century, and it contained such muscular figures as William James, who is the reason we have a course in colleges, academic psychology. That's James Prestige brought that in. And James was a kind of, he had a ligature to Wundt, although Wundt intimidated James a bit, because he wrote so much and so copiously about everything. But in the Metaphysical Club, besides William James, was John Dewey, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and a number of other of the shapers of 20th century American institutions. The most important figure, though, is not known to many people. He's perhaps the last major philosopher human history has produced. He was, it's pronounced Pierce, but it's spelled as if it were Pierce. Charles S. Pierce, a strange figure, a part-time lecturer at Harvard, created the pragmatic philosophy that William James was probably the chief distributor of. But your key man's Pierce, because he's much less, how would I put it? He's much more direct than James. James comes from a long intellectual tradition, a genteel tradition, and in a sense, James knows just what to say in every situation. Pierce is very nakedly describing that pragmatism, he doesn't make this connection, but I have, it's very similar to the old Norse religion that said, praise Icewind Cross, the woman on her deathbed. In other words, no predeterminations until you see performance. Pierce said the truth and justice flatly do not exist. This was picked up, by the way, by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who then said truth and justice are what the strongest members of society say they are, and any sane judge decides a case before he hears the arguments, because you don't want to rattle the framework of society. I mean, this is big time radicalism. Of course, they didn't see it that way at all. They saw it as nitty-gritty truth and all these superstitious, sentimental additions had occluded the fact justice is what strong people say it is. Truth is same thing.
So that's an evolution of Kantian philosophy, where they remove cause and effect, and then they, their irrationality can be rationalized.
Yes, of course, they left out Kant's, it's one of the three critiques. Probably the best intellectual defense for the existence of God is from Kant. That was inconvenient for this group. But pragmatism, if you now connect pragmatism with the concept of justified sinning from Calvin, you have an absolute blank check in any situation to invent truth, invent justice, sacrifice biologically inconsequential people, and invent any excuse for doing that you want. Seems to me that's been the driving force in American affairs for a long, long time there. But interestingly enough, it's been the driving force of an intellectual elite, I believe, through history. It's just they didn't have the dominance the technology gave them.
Well, Bertrand Russell has this quote. He's often misquoted, but when you actually read the book, the sentence starts with, I'll paraphrase, as Fichte would have wanted, the purpose of education is to remove individuality and self-reliance and all these other things. So the idea was that Bertrand Russell was noticing that what Fichte in the 19th century was trying to do but didn't have the technology to do, that they now in the Norbert Wiener, Bertrand Russell era, the 20th century, now had the ability to, you know, mass mind control billions of people at the same time. And it's all done on a basis of irrationality, a denial of cause and effect. But that goes back, you know, you can start looking at where the influence of utopia took place and took root in Francis Bacon with New Atlantis and how it goes up. And then it's just formalized by some people using other jargon, psychology, in the 20th century into pragmatism. And it's all just they want to do what they want to do anyway, and they just keep using education to kind of, you know, say, well, this is a good reason why we're doing this.
Yeah. Well, here we are then.
What thoughts do you have about the amount of people in the origins of this country that were literate versus the amount of people that are literate today?
It's quite fascinating because the political census of Connecticut, I believe it was 1690, but don't hold me to that, very, very early on, showed a population that was, for all practical purposes, entirely literate. We also have the more than circumstantial evidence. If you simply look at the popular writing in early colonial times. It's taught in a seminar level in colleges today. And it's as well known a novel as Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans is in truth unreadable by college friends. Not because he's not a skillful writer, but the allusions to science, politics, history of all sorts is so comprehensive and interwoven that the allusions themselves defeat an ordinary reader, including an ordinary college reader. The book I saw in your bathroom, Common Sense, sold 600,000, sold in a population of 3 million. You know, a country that was half serf, slave, and now you can find it on seminar level in Princeton and University of Chicago.
Because so many people were literate at the origins of this country, they were able to publish these pamphlets. Yeah. And so when you'd have propaganda on behalf of the elector of Hanover, better known as the King of England.
Yeah.
And you had these retorts by, you know, Thomas Paine, who's not from America. He emigrated here and he doesn't have a formal education, but somehow he figures out how to put things together for himself and speak in a way such that the common person can really get something from this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not so much his aspect, you know, his propaganda. He's propagating an idea. But just describe the effect that, you know, just being able to have the printing press and somebody who could pick up these ideas without being through their formal schooling has the power to change and influence a country and inspire a revolution, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yes. And in Paine's case, what he had mastered is even today what I tell kids is priceless to master. No complexity of ideas can't, in fact, with the pains on the part of the speaker, the writer, be reduced to plain talk and speech without harming the delicacy of the idea. And Paine really hit that on the button. He's quite a model in a sense. It's like, if you want to write adventure stories, you want to read Edgar Rice Burroughs and the Tarzan books and the Mars books, because you're just propelled from beginning to end on a somewhat more rarefied level. Dickens had that ability. And of course, it could be distributed wholesale, but doing that would hand weapons to people you don't want to be able to be heard. You know, when you teach people to speak and think in academies, you've reduced their effectiveness to their associates there. So, yeah, no, we had some very productive experiments in mass literacy, including a phrase, a label that's vanished from use. There was constant talk of something called the active literacy. As long as you read well, you can develop original thinking, but you can't communicate it. But to be able to master spoken speech, you can talk to anybody and they can actually understand what you're saying, or written speech, were known as the active literacies. The British government made those a crime, a prisonable offense to teach ordinary people the active literacies, not reading, because you want your flunkies to be able to read so they can follow your orders so you can go and play golf or go fishing. But to actually communicate dissident thinking and writing, you can reach way beyond yourself.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution. This is episode 43, The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. And this is hour three of the five-hour interview. And we've just listened to the first 15 minutes. John talks about many things that have now started to accumulate over the first 2 hours as he set up the foundation, and now he's putting together a building which is becoming visibly disturbing as juxtaposed to the history we were taught about America and public schooling.
I thought it was really great that he got into the fact that there is a traceable funding center in these tax-exempt foundations, and the fact that Norman Dodd and this Reese Committee exposed all of this quite some time ago. So it's on the public record that these wealthy magnates of the 19th century, late 19th century and early 20th century decided to pool their money and resources together at around the same time that they were pushing for both the Federal Reserve and a public income tax. And they created these tax-exempt foundations to essentially be an outstretched arm that could then start printing off textbooks and funding NGOs and creating the bare bones of the public education system that we have today, which is still incidentally funded by some of these same tax-exempt foundations. So even though a lot of this still exists on the congressional record, it hasn't had this effect. People still don't really know that these foundations still control things. It was good that he touched on Pierce and the idea of pragmatism, because a lot of people in university today are taught pragmatic approaches, which really decontextualizes everything and gets you to look only sort of with tunnel vision at an issue, rather than looking at all the contextual history and seeing that there's a lot more to trying to solve a problem than just whacking away at its branches. And of course, our favorite philosopher, Kant, who put forth this kind of false notion, which is, it's believable, but it's fallacious, that you can't possibly know anything for certain, for truth, when I think it's more of a acceptable reality that there is an objective shared reality, and simultaneously we're all projecting our own private reality into that shared reality. So it's like two universes coexisting in the same space, in a sense. So he can be correct on one level, you know, if we were living in the Matrix or everything's a virtual reality, but without getting too deep, there are objective things that we can know, I believe. But the problem with that philosophy and what has sprung from it, you know, is this idea of justified sinning and creating your own truth when there are objective truths that exist. So if you can say that that's not true somehow with a philosophy as an operating system, then yeah, it gives you license to basically create your own reality and then retroactively justify all your unethical decisions by saying, hey, you know, the ends justify the means. I think everyone should try and read more of Edgar Rice Burroughs, especially John Carter and A Princess of Mars. It's an awesome novel, and John Gatto mentions it. It's old, but everyone should read it before the Disney movie comes out. Lastly, the idea with Thomas Paine and how the printing press revolutionized things, not just for propaganda purposes, but also the ability to get out. You know, it was basically the first internet-style revolution where one person could take their energy, take their ideas and something that made common sense, and then replicate it so that it could be distributed to the masses and stimulate some form of conscious awakening. Even if that conscious awakening gets subverted later, at least it started in an effective way and showed that it was possible for someone to sort of distribute their own work, the DIY approach, which I think all of us who are on this call are doing today ourselves. So it's this idea that we can communicate complex ideas without boiling them down so much that they're oversimplified and become pablum. We're trying to communicate ideas effectively through our rhetoric, but a lot of times in this media landscape of 30-second sound bites, you can't communicate an idea of any depth and quality in that short a time space. Or if you can, then you must be an awesome rhetorician. But, you know, people have to learn to get their attention span back, and so that they can listen to more than 30-second sound bites and start considering some larger and more complex ideas, which, of course, are going to build a deeper foundation for everything else you're stacking them on. So that's what I have for notes.
Those are some very astute observations that are highly pertinent to today, especially the part where we get together and kind of use the tools that are available to us to try to resolve a problem set that is not unrelated to that which Thomas Paine was trying to address back in the day.
I've got a couple of things to add here. I was watching Scott Noble's film last night, Human Resources, Social Engineering in the 20th Century, and he discusses the issues of Thomas Paine and the entire engineering of the 20th century. And Paul had mentioned the printing press and how it really revolutionized propaganda. Leo Tolstoy had made a quote that the printing press was a mighty engine for disseminating ignorance. So it's not, you know, people being able to read is by no means a method of freeing one's mind. In fact, those who can read are actually more easily controlled. So it is all about the systematic method of breaking information down and analyzing it and fact-checking it, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, you know, before you pass that information on, the rhetoric aspect, so that we're always fact-checking ourselves and filtering this bad information before we pass it on. And ironically, this film, Human Resources, features long segments of John Taylor Gatto.
What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on a lot of what Paul said there. I think you guys both made some really good points in that Charles Peirce, this ideology is not new. I mean, that he's presenting, it's something that he's really packaging for himself and he gets a lot of credit for. But this idea can be found in the utilitarian principles. It can also be found in the idea of, as you said, the ends justify the means or do as thou wilt, going back to Adam Weishaupt. So, and I think there's some historical connections to be explored there. But William James said that truth for us was simply a collective name for the verification process. And what they're describing is basically the idea of communities of inquiry, in quotes, versus chaos, wherein the best opinion wins out. And these subjective understandings of truth that promote what they called the absence of principles or the absence of moral standards, you know, negating any idea that truth can be found through any kind of inquiry. So the best way for them to mask this is to have this community that gets to profit off of the intellectual capital gained from this ideology overtaking American political science, our education system, our medical system, across the board. So, and Dewey puts it as, in quotes, knowledge is belief authorized by inquiry. And that is the pragmatic concept of truth. It's best opinion of the day wins.
One of the things I found interesting is how he mentioned Charles S. Peirce, creative pragmatism, and, there's no truth in justice, no predetermination until performance is what Gatto mentioned, and how the Metaphysical Club kind of combined all these different philosophies that Gatto already outlined for us and showed all these connections, and how it tied back to what he mentioned was to Calvin, right? And so what's interesting is, like, it really just stems back to the irrational denial of truth. It really goes back to Kant. And I remember when Neon interviewed David Haramein, and Haramein mentioned his Philosophic Corruption of Physics, how all these different isms, such as pragmatism, utilitarianism, nihilism, Darwinism, all these different isms of the time, what they really represent is, on a metaphysical and epistemological foundation, a denial of existence and a denial of our five senses as a way to come to know our reality. And from there, they then devised an ethics and standards of morals that came into support their own power elite structure, or by which they can exert their own truth onto the will of the people and then go ahead and compartmentalize and go ahead, you know, treat us as some sort of breeding ground. The only other thing I'll go ahead and mention is that he mentioned how Paine had such a, one of the brilliant things he mastered was the ability to communicate simplistic ideas of, you know, complex concepts or situations. And that's really a lost art today, because whenever that's confronted, what's mainly lost are the intricate details of something complex. But, you know, with a good understanding of the trivium, and really I think a good understanding of general grammar and going over our definitions, we can come to more succinctly understand how to properly define certain circumstances and concepts and build out a better understanding as to what some of these complex situations, such as all these different isms and concepts and theories in physics, for example, or in schooling. And you can really come to, I believe Aristotle was the one that pointed to the fact that he always tried to define things in, with one or two syllable words and very succinct and small phrases, something to that effect. I butchered that a bit there. But nonetheless, it still remains true that if a mark of a man with great knowledge is someone who can define in very succinct and complete terms.
Well, you have to be able to adopt different social idioms, use different metaphors to extract and abstract that information in your communication. And what he mentions about academies, speaking in academies limits your message only to the people who are likewise academics and can understand it. And so he's juxtaposing this idea of academic speech versus, to use a colloquial term, truck driver speech, mono or dual syllabic words that are easily understood by everyone, that paints out a picture in your imagination. It communicates more than the words themselves literally communicate on the page. That also has to do with people's context. And in the founding years of this country, people had a much broader and more defined context from which to draw from history. Thomas Paine could draw a couple words from Shakespeare and communicate a huge idea because his audience was familiar with these concepts and these metaphorical allusions. And that's when Gatto says, people today, they can't handle the allusions. There's all these called upon pieces of history that you need to know about to understand what one of these people is writing about. And that's how they're able to abstract and so succinctly boil things down, because it's only through the use of these other called upon ideas that are in the common vernacular, in the common knowledge, that you're able to boil these things down or distill them down such that they're manageable and yet simple, but still communicating these complex ideas.
And just to reinforce a little bit of what Gatto said there about the active literacies in the colonies, I have a book here entitled Albion Seed, Four British Folkways in America by David Hackett Fisher. In the first chapter in Social Statuses here, it says the social status of these people also appeared in their high levels of literacy. Two-thirds of New England's adult male immigrants were able to sign their own names. In Old England before 1640, only about one-third could do so. By this very rough signature mark test, literacy was nearly twice as common in Massachusetts as in the mother country.
At the beginning of the interview, he uses this term that I had never heard before, bête noire, I believe.
Bête noire.
Bête noire.
It's pronounced B-E-T apostrophe N-W-A-R, if that was phonetically spelled, and it's accurately spelled. It's a French term, B-E-T-E-N-O-I-R-E.
From the French literally meaning black beast, first used in 1828, and the definition is a person or thing strongly detested or avoided.
And that was the bête noire that day. So.
And he's referring to.
Oh, he's referring to. He's referring to the recent Cox Committee, and that they termed it as communism, this thing that they found, and they were having trouble naming the agenda. And so I was pointing toward Adam Weishaupt and the orders of the Illuminati and their agenda of the perfectibilists. And Gatto responds with saying, there was an even more recent one at Harvard that's much more directly influential in America because it's working off the Illuminati plan, but it's called the Metaphysical Club, and it takes place and takes root in Harvard. And there are such luminaries as Oliver Wendell Holmes and John Dewey and these other characters. And so I'd just like to quickly read a passage from the Metaphysical Club by Louis Menand. This is page 324. A Kantian like Wundt therefore assumed that every mental state, no matter how complicated, can be broken down into simple bits of sense data that have been combined by the operation of various mental processes: perception, attention, cognition, discrimination, comparison, association, and so on. Wundt thought that the purpose of physiological psychology was to study these processes and to study something meant for him, as it would for almost any 19th century scientist, to measure it. When people came to work in Wundt's laboratory in Leipzig, that is what they did. So the page that contains Dewey, it contains William James on the next page, is discussing how these people are trying to measure the human mind in order to control it, not to liberate it. It's directly talking about methods of control, and that's what Peirce and pragmatism and Wundt and all these guys were about.
And going back to the agenda that they detected, Norman Dodd in the Rees Committee, Norman Dodd lays it out in his interview with G. Edward Griffin. I actually have the transcript. This is the part of the interview where Griffin is asking Dodd about Catherine Casey and her experience at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And the endowment had invited Dodd to send someone from his team to review their corporate records. And he went back to Washington after meeting with the president of the Carnegie Endowment and, quote, selected a member of my staff who had been a practicing attorney in Washington, That's Catherine Casey. She was on my staff to see to it that I didn't break any congressional procedures or rules, in addition to which she was unsympathetic to the purpose of the investigation. She was level-headed and a very reasonably brilliant, capable lady. Her attitude toward the investigation was, "What could possibly be wrong with foundations? They do so much good." Well, in the face of that sincere conviction of Catherine's, I went out of my way not to prejudice her in any way, but I did explain to her that she couldn't possibly cover 50 years of written minutes in 2 weeks, so she would have to concentrate on what we called spot reading. I blocked off certain periods of time to concentrate on, and off she went to New York. Continuing on, we are now at the year 1908, which was the year that the Carnegie Foundation began operations. In that year, the trustees, meeting for the first time, raised a specific question, which they discussed throughout the balance of the year in a very learned fashion. The question is, quote, "Is there any means known more effective than war, assuming you wish to alter the life of an entire people?" End quote. And they conclude that no more effective means than war to that end is known to humanity. So then in 1909, they raised the second question and discussed it, namely, how do we involve the United States in a war? Well, I doubt at that time if there was any subject more removed from the thinking of most of the people in this country than its involvement in a war. Moving forward, then, finally, they answered that question as follows, quote, "We must control the State Department." That very naturally raises the question of how do we do that? And they answer it by saying, "We must take over and control the diplomatic machinery of this country." And finally, they resolve to aim at that as an objective. Then he goes on to say time passes and eventually we are in a war, which would be World War I. And at that time, they, the Carnegie Endowment, record in their minutes a shocking report in which they dispatched to President Wilson a telegram cautioning him to see that the war does not end too quickly. Finally, he says, the war is over. At that time, their interest shifts over to preventing what they call a reversion of life in the United States to what it was prior to 1914 when World War I broke out. At that point, they came to the conclusion that to prevent a reversion, quote, "We must control education in the United States," end quote. They realize that that's a pretty big task. It is too big for them alone. So they approach the Rockefeller Foundation with the suggestion that the portion of education which could be considered domestic be handled by the Rockefeller Foundation, and that the portion which is international should be handled by the endowment. They then decide that the key to success of these two operations lay in the alteration of the teaching of American history. This is great. So they approach four of the then most prominent teachers of American history in the country, people like Charles and Mary Byrd, and their suggestion to them is, will they alter the manner in which they present their subject? And they got turned down flat. So then they decide that it is necessary for them to do as they say, quote, build our own stable of historians. They then approach the Guggenheim Foundation, which specializes in fellowships, and say, quote, when we find young men in the process of studying for doctorates in the field of American history, and we feel that they are the right caliber, will you grant them fellowships on our say-so, end quote? And the answer is yes. So under that condition, eventually they assembled 20, and they take this 20 potential teachers of American history to London, and there they're briefed on what is expected of them, and if they secure appointments in keeping with the doctorates they will have earned. That group of 20 historians ultimately becomes the nucleus of the American Historic Association. Toward the end of the 1920s, the endowment grants to the American Historical Association $400,000 for a study of our history in a manner which points toward what this country can look forward to in the future.
And I would just add a small point to that, that the first president of the American Historical Association was Andrew Dixon White of the Yale Troika.
And what role does the Yale Troika play in all this again, Kev?
Well, the Yale Troika, Andrew Dixon White, Timothy Dwight, and Daniel Coit Gilman, they were some of the first students following in the tradition of Edward Everett to go get Prussian PhDs. And Andrew Dixon White, Daniel Coit Gilman, and Timothy Dwight all studied at the University of Berlin, the University of Leipzig, and the University of Bonn, and where they obtained their PhDs. Now, Daniel Coit Gilman was the incorporator of the Skull and Bones Trust with William Huntington Russell. And William Huntington Russell, as you will find when researching, his family is responsible for opium dealing throughout history. But Daniel Coit Gilman goes on to become the first president of Johns Hopkins University, and he becomes the first head of the Carnegie Institute for Science, in which Andrew Dixon White had went to Carnegie's castle in Ireland and agreed to formulate this structure in the United States.
All right, and to wrap up this first 15 minutes, we covered the Cox Committee, the Walsh. The Walsh Committee was what happened in pre-1920 during World War I, and that investigation never really got done. So in the 50s, Cox and the Rees Committee, they're looking at this regime change agenda in America and who is funding it. It's these big foundations. That was the bête noire of that day. This Illuminati agenda working through the metaphysical club, working through agents of this Prussian education system like Pestalozzi, Fichte, Kant, Lavater. And then you have Wundt and his ligature to William James and pragmatism. That ties you into Charles Sanders Peirce. And when you get to study this stuff, when you get to the point where you dig into these primary sources and you look at Charles Sanders Peirce and his lectures, I think it's the 1905 season of lectures at Harvard, you can really see that, as Gatto says, Charles Sanders Peirce isn't covering up his words. He's stating it as if we never have access to this today to read it ourselves. He's an elite talking to other elite about how to manage us. He does it in a very non-veiled way. So Charles Sanders Peirce. There's also this whole idea that you could rattle the framework of society if you actually had truth and justice going on in the court as logical debate based on what exists. But he says it's nothing of the sort, that justice and truth are what strong people say it is. And that's might makes right. That is irrational, because anything that is not violating someone else's volition, you wouldn't need to use force, fraud, or coercion to get what you want. You only have to use these irrational forms of violence, fraud, coercion, etc., when you are acting outside of logical cause and effect. And then he's talking about Kant's critique of pure reason and this combination between pragmatism and Calvin. So when you add Calvin plus Peirce, you have bringing democracy via force, fraud, and coercion to everyone in the world. I brought up Bertrand Russell and Norbert Wiener. This is the whole idea of using science to add this additional layer on top of Wundt and Kant and Pestalozzi and these other ideas of how to control people. And then that gets into how can we get out of this? Well, it's more than literacy that we need. We need active literacy, which means we learn something and are then able to communicate it, whether it's through truck driver speech or academies. These are all ways of trying to communicate with each other, and it depends on your audience, which social idiom you have to adopt. So it was a crime in the past to teach these sort of things, and we think it's a crime in the present not to teach these sort of things. So we see the active literacies as an essential part of the peace revolution.
But to actually communicate dissident thinking and writing, you can reach way beyond yourself. So the active literacies are, you find in the handful of elite private boarding schools, this tradition preserved. And in fact, in the academy tradition all over the world, there's a clear understanding that to be able to blink your eyes and knock off 300 words on anything at all, including a subject you know nothing about, is de rigueur. And so it is to be able to speak fluently, even on things you don't. Well, you can see, and I would love to know how it was done. The current president is masterful, not just good, he's masterful at the nuances of speech. That can only doesn't happen naturally there. Where on earth was that training? There are little figures he uses that have fancy Latin names to them.
Sure.
There. And of course, Bill Clinton was no slouch, but he comes out of a populist preacher tradition and is masterful with what he does. But the other is a formally trained science of speech. And I listened to the modulations and how he can shift from one idiom to another. And I said, somebody with this odd background, you know, all over the world, who's my daddy, who's my mommy, you know, something intervened there. It's no accident, by the way, that Bill Clinton suddenly emerges from a state in which Rockefeller is the governor.
Who was Bill Clinton's mentor?
Well, he has a variety of mentors. The very fact that he steered into Yale, which is probably of the elite universities, the one that keeps the class tradition, the British class tradition, most actively alive. In fact, they all fled from Harvard when the Unitarians took over and are talking, we're all in this together. So they bailed out of Harvard, headed west, dropped the biggest load, no pun intended, in New Haven, but continued on a line that you can trace all the way across to Seattle, leaving behind traces of this brilliant class-based thought. I once, years ago, and don't ask me to reclaim it now, but I once actually did trace the movement from the evacuation of Harvard in about 1805, 1810. What had happened was the Unitarians, who were one of the great heresies of the last 500 years, they worked out a way to initially convert to whatever religion had a church in the area, and then when they were the majority, they would vote the thing out of business, take the assets, and reopen as a Unitarian parish. The entire Massachusetts School Committee, no accident, every last member was a Unitarian, even though there were less than 1% of the Massachusetts population, because they understood leverage. What is the symbol of the Fabian socialists in Britain? It's the wolf in sheep's clothing. They had a big laugh at how easy it is, to fool. The funny thing is that Kitty Muggeridge, Beatrice Webb, who is really Fabian socialism. She carried her husband around, but Beatrice is the welfare state architect. She was the niece of Herbert Spencer, the most articulate intellectual racist in human history. Root hog or die. She sat with him on his deathbed for 6 weeks, and both of them agreed they were after the identical goals, but by different means. He said, exterminate the brutes, the famous line from Heart of Darkness, and she said, kill them with kindness. I noticed you had Ayn Rand on your shelf. The idea of taking care of somebody else, apart from the innocent charitable thing, is that you ruin them by doing that. It doesn't take very long to ruin them. So Beatrice Webb, the Fabian, and the great conservative Herbert Spencer, same bloodline, same goals, different methodology.
Fabian socialists also founded the London School of Economics, yes, among many other things. Sidney and Beatrice Webb were working with Arthur Balfour and the Society for Psychical Research, I believe. And one of the other characters that was spinning in that crowd was a guy named William T. Stead, who was editor of the Review of the Reviews, died in the Titanic, and was the editor-in-chief over that last will and testament of Cecil John.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, and I have no idea how he pronounced his name, but I would call it Steed. It was the character in The Lady with the Black Leather. What was? A sort of international spy series on television about 20 years ago. Diana Rigg, what was the female lead. Yeah. And Steed was an inside joke.
Kind of like the James Bond films are an inside joke to MI6 and Ian Fleming's whole career. And James Bond was an ornithologist, which is a bird watcher, which is what James Bond is. He's watching girls and playing this whole game for the De Beers cartel, which controls.
And if you believe in justified sinning, that's what a license to kill is. It's for Her Majesty or whoever.
Well, and Thomas Paine had some words to write about where monarchies draw their idealistic power and who created crowns and these sort of ideas where somebody is born into a situation where they're allowed to rule over other people. And that's a collectivist mentality where they expect you to sacrifice yourself to the state. So Prussian schooling is definitely created to uphold that status quo. What is the equal and opposite? How do people transition themselves and remain individual and grow and learn and do these things for themselves?
Well, I think there are a variety of smaller inspirations. Besides the fact that if you and I are correct, it's the natural instinct of people who've sort of been made aware of the life and the arc of a life. But oddly enough, the Congregationalists are very, the little white-spired, beautiful churches that once, I believe, you couldn't vote in this state unless you were one. They taught that the Presbyterians, as Milton said, new presbyter is but old priest writ large, because they met together once a year. And he said, that will ruin you, having this collective mentality. The congregation is sovereign in a real congregationalist church. I don't know how they've mutated through history. And the minister is simply, you know, the official of the moment to organize the back and forth. But the minute the minister becomes cheeky or out of line, out he goes, and usually if he asks for more money, because the minister is a functionary, the congregation gets the word directly from God. This is, of course, Martin Luther's enormous breakthrough, which he couldn't sustain, that it's probably the great freeing line in human history. Every man his own priest. No organization is necessary. The communication's direct. Congregationalists modified it and said there's some value in other people's opinion, but not too many others. The people who show up and donate to the church. Yeah, we want to hear what they all have to say. But the minister, you know. So that was one source for a long time. These dissenting and independent religions that were unwelcome in Britain came here, and there's so much space, and it was so disorganized outside of cities. I mean, we had this infinite splintering. So that was one sort. I think the scale of the country itself, which couldn't be really monitored until very recently, long ago it occurred to me that when you have to depend on, say, horses, no telephones, no iPads, when you get about 20 miles from the center, they don't know what you're doing. Once a year, blue moon, they send somebody out and you say whatever the guy wants to hear. Back goes, it looks like everything's cool. That's how we had. There are no continuous governments in human history. None of them last very long, and I'm sure it's because this ferment on the fringe, which isn't very far away, eventually is fatal to the idea that, you know, the hierarchy must be preserved.
I think that's just a sign that there's so many people in this country. When things can get that obviously irrational, that there's just no intellectual self-defense, there's no one left to form, you know, a sentence, let alone a paragraph, let alone have the power to get it printed in front of millions of people anymore. And that's what I noticed.
And no editor would dare print it anyway for fear the ads would dry up.
Senator Oscar Calloway, in 1917, addressed to Congress, and he said that the J.P. Morgan interests, the shipbuilding powder interests, had all gotten together and bought the top editor. You know, they placed editors at the top 25 newspapers in order to control the content on political policy and military policy. So that was really the declaration, the first origins of the Council on Foreign Relations, which goal is to kind of control and mold the minds of the masses using official experts and historians and
so these clues won't leak. How about Harry Truman's speech before the U.S. Senate in 1942 denouncing the Rockefeller interests as traitors because they were selling oil to both sides? What he didn't know was that the Krupp cannon makers were doing the same thing, making the German cannon, selling them to the French or anyone else who would buy them. They had already become a virtual global society. But Truman's denunciation of the Rockefellers on the floor of the Senate, you would think that would be just elementary sharing with generations of school kids. No, doesn't exist for all practical purposes, unless you're willing to sit in the, well, my generation, sit in the library stacks and go through. I did that in Columbia. I said, I'm going to find out, oh no, I'm going back to 1958. So I got a stack pass. I've heard about stack pass. I'm down like in the sixth level. There's these huge stacks of popular magazines. He says, you know, I'm interested to find out what the popular newspapers and magazines said about the Second World War before it started, for like the 90 days before it started. Let me tell you two a publication. There not only was a certainty there was going to be war, but no worry at all. They all agreed that there was no ability on the part of any potential enemy to sustain a war, that all the gains would be right away, then they couldn't replace their losses.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 43. That was minutes 15 through 30 of hour 3, the ultimate history lesson, weekend with John Taylor Gatto. In this 15 minutes, I think, is some of the most densely packed and most important information that he's laid out thus far, because he's not only shown you the grammar of the who, what, when, where, and why, he's now telling you about the how. Here's how they do it. Here's how they're doing it. Here's how they're funded. And you know, kind of here's what their big picture is. He starts off comparing the 1800s, and that if you lived 20 miles outside of town, that maybe once or twice a year somebody would come out and check on you and see what was going on. But otherwise, what you were doing was completely off the grid. You weren't able to be effectively managed. They couldn't come and tax you and do all these other things. And so with the census, with these other tactics of schooling, they make the population more manageable. Then they also bring in the income tax in 1913. And so these are all methods of trying to control human beings. And what he's noting is that in human history, there's no continuous governments, that eventually these people who live on the fray, who are getting more and more managed by the day, eventually revolt and they overthrow the government because they do not consent to being managed by people who don't know them, by people who aren't taking into account their interests of survival. And so there's no need to give their consent to that. And so over human history, it's been a struggle of people to be self-reliant, to be able to manage their own selves, and to be able to have the
product of their labor be their own property. And so he's just describing layer upon layer of governmental bureaucratic control that's been implemented all throughout our society and throughout our culture, but we've been born into it and conditioned to think that this has always been here, this is always the way it's always gone on, that everyone's always been taxed, and that there are all these different laws that have been made without your consent, without your approval, to which you were not a party to these agreements, but there are these people called authorities, and they're seeking to do what they want with you, even though you're not consenting.
As the old saying goes, there are two things that you do in life, pay taxes and die. So somebody had to sell that meme out into the culture.
Well, and I would note that it takes them a tremendous amount of propaganda and all these types of different resources coming from different angles, whether it's education or through the newspaper or what have you, to preserve these contrived structures that they've built up through history. And recently, in the last 100 years, they've been using technology and advanced methods of psychology and basically everything at their disposal. So in a very von Clausewitz type of way, they are waging absolute war. It's not just on a battlefield. It's not just with people in uniforms. It's against everybody. It's against men, women, and children. They're coming at you through your education, through your food, through your water, through your air, through the things you buy to try to survive. They're coming at you from everywhere. And so this is all Prussian thinking.
And they even attack each other is the irony of it, because they get caught in their own lies.
But Gatto brings up another important point, which is that they noticed, or he noticed, that all these magazines are noticing that pre-World War II, everyone recognizes, well, yeah, we could have a war, but none of these people we're fighting against can sustain it. I likewise would have to mention that, yes, these people are trying to control us, but they cannot sustain the propaganda. They cannot sustain the hold over your consciousness once you put thinking back between stimulus and response. If the Hegelian dialectic is known as problem, reaction, solution, then that, in everyday truck driver speech, is stimulus, reaction, enslavement. And all you have to do to get yourself out of that formula for slavery, stimulus, reaction, slavery, is put thinking in between the stimulus and reaction, and now you have stimulus, thinking, reaction, freedom. That's the difference. That's what we're all trying to bring together. Kevin?
Yes, how he went into the science of speech and the power of rhetoric transitioning into these new forms, as you just discussed, what I wanted to reiterate there. But also, he kind of slips in there this idea of Yale as the continuation of the British class system. And I would refer people back to the previous Peace Revolution, where Fletcher Prouty describes Elihu Yale as a former employee of the British East India Company, where he has the British East India Company flag on his wall. And he's donating this money via goods that Cotton Mather later proposed changing the Collegiate College of Connecticut to Yale College. And that's where we get that continuation of that class system. A couple other points he brought up, you know, the connection between Beatrice Webb and Herbert Spencer, the idea of either killing them with kindness or the idea of root hog or die.
Let me just interject there for a second, Cove. When he said root hog or die, I caught that stuck in my head when I was editing because I didn't know what it meant. So I finally looked it up, and root hog or die was a slang term meaning self-reliance in the early 19th century. And later it was redefined by the social Darwinists like Herbert Spencer and W.G. Sumner. So what they do is, Gatto said in, I think, hour one, how do they take control? They redefine your language. And so this root hog or die, this self-reliance cry that basically came around in the 18th century, was about when they would have too many hogs, for instance, you'd have to let the hog out. It's no longer going to be managed by the rancher. It's going to have to be self-reliant. That hog will have to root to get its food, or it will die, right? So they would kind of say this, root hog or die, right?
Right.
And so this term of independence, of self-reliance, of autonomy, then is redefined by these social Darwinists, who are not our friends, apparently. And then it's associated with Herbert Spencer. So when he's recalling Herbert Spencer having this conversation with Beatrice Webb, that's why, to his mind, that's the little soundbite that comes up about Herbert Spencer, root hog or die. But that's only after it's been redefined by the social Darwinists.
And then it becomes a process of quote-unquote natural selection, where they can justify people falling
sinning. Yeah.
Right. They can justify people dying or people not having access to health care or people not having access to good education as a result of these ideas. But the other points that he brought up about the Society for Psychical Research, a lot of that can be found in Tragedy and Hope. I would recommend people look into the affiliations of Edward Piasi one of the founders of the Fabian Society with Beatrice Webb, that came out of the Fellowship of the New Life of Thomas Davidson, which is responsible for the Fabian Society splintering off and existing in the first place. Frank Podmore would be another individual to look into.
I think it's interesting if we think about which schools are still teaching sophisticated rhetoric, this idea of persuasive speech, even using fallacies, and what types of people use sophist, fallacious rhetoric for a living, right? Whether they're lawyers or politicians or whatever, and what other groups of employment that exist out there. It's, I think, a good idea to examine who exactly is using this, and right, how are they making money? Because a lot of these people that use it get paid like $400 an hour, right? And I'm talking about their tonality, their pacing, their choices of words, word definitions. You know, it's, they've basically been taught the art of argumentation, but on a kind of unfair level, because, like I said, a lot of these people are using fallacies against people who aren't equipped with any form of intellectual self-defense.
And then because they don't have intellectual self-defense, they become victims of the force, fraud, and coercion that is articulated through sophisticated views that are trying to take away your free will without your full consent.
Exactly. So I thought it was interesting that you mentioned Clinton's mentors, and Carol Quigley, of course, comes to mind, and Tragedy and Hope being his kind of major opus on laying out all the complementary information to everything that John talks about in the interview. This idea of the Anglo-American establishment coming to, you know, New Haven and New England, that whole area of the northeastern states, and bringing with them this British class tradition, which they kind of rooted into the Ivy League college and university system, which would be the last places where you could kind of be taught the trivium and these forms of sophisticated rhetoric, and still maintain this kind of Greek tradition of fraternal orders, which would be the feeders for the secret societies, right? Yale and Harvard being like the most, not popular so much as having the ones that are the most influence in who's running today's affairs. But it's interesting that it's usually like presidents and people, again, who have to use sophisticated rhetoric that come from these different fraternal orders. So that must be one of the, you know, being that really the fraternal orders are in a way teaching people the trivium, right? That's their...
Well, his comments about Obama having all these skills about being able to adopt different idioms and these different types of speech. I mean, Obama went to University of Chicago, which was founded and funded by the Rockefeller family.
That's exactly right. And Obama, it's also important to note that technology allows people to speak. Like you can definitely see a difference between politicians in the 20s and 30s and politicians today. The major difference is that Obama's usually got these two 45-degree tilted clear plastic screens that he's constantly tilting his head exactly left to right to left to right and speaking. And then they're positioned at an angle where it doesn't look like he's quite reading. And so you can almost pull off the act that it's really, you know, thoughts of his coming from his mind. And that's the articulation, right? Somebody else is writing the speech more often than not.
Absolutely. They have speech writers. They have advanced technology. He's usually got an earbud in with someone else talking to him that you can't see off, you know, on screen, as opposed to like a newscaster who might need to hear the person he's interviewing, right? And so the idea that Obama recently was giving a speech, I don't know if it was in Tennessee, but he was dropping his G's because he was adopting an artificial idiom to speak to an audience, to use advanced, sophisticated rhetorical methods against these people. And I believe it was the Associated Press who created the hubbub by accurately transcribing what he was saying. And then all these other groups came out and said, because it's an accurate transcription of what he was saying, that it was racist, that the transcriber should have added the G's and changed the words so that people reading the transcript wouldn't notice this different social idiom being expressed for the purpose of manipulating an audience.
Yeah, well, and I think that's just indicative of someone practicing Fabian socialism. That's what was taught at these universities, including, you know, Rockefeller's Chicago University.
How would you define Fabian socialism? What is that all about, Paul?
Well, it's essentially this idea of being a wolf in sheep's clothing, right? Fabian socialism, the Fabius part is to do with Fabius Maximus, the Roman general, who used this kind of war of attrition to, you know, hide essentially amongst people when conducting warfare, so as in order to infiltrate and spread the root of your ideas or in this case, you know, your warfare, more effectively amongst smaller people, right? And so it's symbolized by the wolf in sheep's clothing because it would be like, you know, the people would be the sheep and amongst them are wolves dressed as sheep so that they can blend in. But when those other sheep, the so-called innocent sheep aren't looking, then the wolves can grab one or two and act like nothing else happened.
Now, are we actually talking about wolves and sheep, or is that a metaphor, Paul?
It's a huge metaphor. The wolves symbolize the predatory class, and the sheep represent the supposed 99% of us who are not necessarily adequately equipped to defend ourselves against the wolf-slash-predator class.
Excellent. Thank you.
Herbert Spencer, root hog or die. I think that's it's not a phrase that I was familiar with, but it symbolizes exactly the sort of mentality, I guess, of, you know, similar to, I guess, evolve or perish. And it's really easy to blame the, if you want to call them the victim class. There's a lot of blame to go around, but ultimately the responsibility does rest in the victim to get over it and learn and grow from it and become stronger. Otherwise, you stay in that victim class, unfortunately, right? And that's not to minimize the fact that many of us have been victimized by the system. It's just that the system wants us to stay in the victim mentality so that we don't do anything about it. So that's this, and keep giving away our power and basically be stuck in a hamster wheel of victimization. So, you know, killing the brutes versus killing them with kindness. Well, that's the empowering, the false empowerment of the victim mentality, right? Is the state pretends to take care of us and keeps the slaves as comfortable as possible versus just like, you know, the men with guns will still use force to make their coercion effective, but they offer us all these other platitudes like welfare and employment and all these things so that we'll at least have this layer where it catches us before we'll instantly revolt or want to fight back, right? It kind of softens the blow. So we hold out for these other considerations before we take more critical action, right? And that's part of the killing us with kindness. Okay, and then rushing through the rest of my notes here, Rich mentions the London School of Economics and Arthur Balfour, of course, the Balfour Declaration, Paris 1919, and that whole thing is very interesting to understand that part of history. But he's tied to, yeah, William T. Stead, creator of The Interview, and Cecil John Rhodes, of course, the Rhodes Will and Trust, or Will and Testament, which talks about the creation of these secret societies based around the Round Table, and of course, the Council on Foreign Relations being the largest still existing manifestation of that.
Where's that roundtable? That roundtable thing that you just mentioned, where's that headquartered? Is that out of a university, an educational institution in Britain?
Yeah, that's Oxford University, or where the Rhodes Scholars would be from. So it's interesting that ties back to Bill Clinton, Rachel Maddow, George Stephanopoulos, many other Rhodes Scholars who were basically taught the art of internationalism in addition to persuasive rhetoric. You'll notice anyone who's a Rhodes Scholar, whether they're there for athletics or for political reasons, for whatever, are taught the art of persuasive rhetoric. It's like par for the course there. And of course, that's to further the internationalist aims, which are, of course, secretly, you know, this idea of the virtual global society, right, which is really translates to easier human livestock management. Gatto mentions ties Steed from the Avengers to William T. Stead, which I thought was interesting. Steed was played by Ralph Fiennes in the movie version of the Avengers, which nobody should bother seeing. But it gives rise to this idea of programming the cultural mind with characters like James Bond and these other glorified, quote-unquote, secret agents who effectively are given license to kill by the government or by the queen, who in turn has had their power given to them by the Pope or supposedly by God. So you're essentially killing, you're essentially licensed to be a justified sinner, and it glorifies this life where, hey, if you're killing people for a living, you might as well do everything else. So like the newest version of James Bond is like almost like a recovering alcoholic or something. He's, you know, just like super hard edged and in an attempt to, you know, make it more realistic and relatable. So, but again, this reinforces the notion of expectation for people to sacrifice themselves to the state this idea of the greater good when, you know, if the state is this ship, we have to look at who's captaining the ship. And if the captain of the ship is drunk with power and acting completely irrationally and steering us towards icebergs or land or whatever without slowing down the ship, then we have to say, like, at what point do we mutiny and say, listen, captain, you've gone crazy and we need to at least, you know, stick some oars in the ocean and counter row, or at least.
Well, and that makes me think of, even though I'm not a big fan of the Republic and the ideas in it, in there, Plato talks about the helmsmen of the ship and how they don't have people who can actually navigate running the ship, et cetera. And the Greek word for helmsman or someone who steers is cybernetes. And that brings up Norbert Wiener and cybernetics and his whole philosophy and use of mathematics and psychology to control and manage human livestock. And if you can't be controlled or managed, then the society, the status quo, the establishment treats you like a pest. And they, just like people have different ways of getting rid of pests, the government and the powers that be have come up with all sorts of different poisons, whether it's genetically modified foods or vaccinations or all these other things that if you go and do the grammar and find out what are the origins, root causes, form, and function of these things, they are not for our best interest, and we have to realize that we as human beings have predators on this planet. We have natural predators, and that our predators, who are human beings, have created their own predators to prey on us called corporations and these bodies and proxies. So, I mean, if we're not prepared at all by letting us know that we as human beings have natural predators, pretty much everything else is off the table. You can't protect yourself if you think that we have no natural predators and that everything is set up in our best interest.
Yeah, corporations are basically predator vehicles, right? If a person is a predator or whatever, they can build a predator vehicle that can hold even people who aren't predators inside to form the machine of the predation, right? I'll just go through these last like three notes here.
Well, let me add to that, Paul, that sure. when they do that, then they become immune to any repercussions for their actions through that corporation.
Exactly, which then causes further irrationality because they don't have someone there to tell them no. Right?
So that's in its form and function, prophylactic?
There's no cause and effect for their actions at all, so then they live in this delusional, irrational world.
Yeah, a growing bubble. So that's the reason that we need intellectual self-defense, and the reason the lack thereof is causing so much trouble is because when you have that dialectic to double check with yourself, like, wait, is this rational? Is this in my own best interest and the best interest of everyone around me? Then it keeps you from going too far out into delusion because, again, you measure the consequences of your actions. When it came to dumbing down the population, I think the rich banksters like J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller, who was called out, of course, by Harry Truman for funding both sides of World War II, they learn to usurp media control, that the best effective means of keeping their own control under wraps would be to control the public voices, the newspapers, the emerging radio and television markets. And, you know, you have to understand that the CIA paying off CNN reporters is because the CIA was created by Wall Street bankers. And so it's the bankers paying off reporters through a government intelligence arm, but it's the same people paying these people to be on message, which is don't talk about these key issues, marginalize or play down anyone who does talk about these issues, and promote this virtual global society, which will be this easier version of livestock management. And essentially that is the cover for all this war profiteering, right? So the bankers are funding both sides of wars, selling weapons through funding through military industrial complex because banks have to hold all that money. Then they fund the rebuilding and, of course, the debts that have to pay for everything, which is the trap because of the interest.
You're talking about Prussia in the 1800s that led up to Nazi Germany? Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about right now. The same thing.
I thought he was talking about Jacques Fresco and the Zeitgeist movement. I'm totally
You can apply. See, it's a formula that these guys have mastered that they know is effective on populations that are disarmed from intellectual self-defense. So all you have to do is recognize the formula, and then you can identify the different choke points as to where you can stop the formula from continuing to go on. And their whole time, they're going to be trying to attack the freedom of speech so that we can't communicate freely and learn our way to freedom. And having the internet right now is the one thing that's allowing us to communicate on an un-before-seen level to allow us to learn our way to freedom. And so that's why, yeah, this last 15 minutes of John is probably one of the most important in the 5 hours.
Paul just mentioned a couple of minutes ago Wall Street and the media, and Gatto mentioned Senator Oscar Calloway's 1917 speech.
I mentioned it.
Oh, did you mention it?
Yeah.
Okay. Which I pulled up, and Calloway's speech, as inserted in the record in 1917, reads, quote, "In March 1915, the J.P. Morgan interests, the steel, shipbuilding, and powder interests, and their subsidiary organizations got together 12 men high up in the newspaper world and employed them to select from the most influential papers in the United States a sufficient number of them to control generally the policy of the daily press of the United States. These 12 men worked the problem out by selecting 179 newspapers and then began by an elimination process to retain only those necessary for the purpose of controlling the general policy of the daily press throughout the country. They found it was only necessary to purchase the control of 25 of the greatest newspapers. The 25 papers were agreed upon. Emissaries were sent to purchase the policy, national and international, of these papers. An agreement was reached. The policy of the papers was bought to be paid for by the month. An editor was furnished for each paper to properly supervise and edit information regarding the questions of preparedness, militarism, financial policies, and other things of national and international nature considered vital to the interests of the purchasers."
You know, a perfect example of this taking place is here in the United States with Henry P. Davison working for J.P. Morgan, who is a Skull and Bones guy, going out to found Time Life magazine, where he puts Henry Luce, who is also Skull and Bones, as the president of Time Life. And then he put, you know, and then they put C.D. Jackson, who's
that's
the head
of Time
US.
Life that had Hitler on the cover, right? That,
the yeah, the Time Life that had Hitler on the cover. And then they put C.D. Jackson as vice president of Time Life. And Kennedy assassination buffs will remember C.D. Jackson as the guy who bought the Zapruder film and stashed it away at the Time Life archive so that nobody could study it. And meanwhile, there's all of these other little cliques going on between George DeMorenshield, who was suicided. George DeMorenshield's wife worked for Zapruder. George DeMorenshield is tied in with this guy, R. Gordon Wasson, who are all tied in with Luce and with all of these other guys making this tight little clique. So at the same time, they're controlling this mass of these 25 conglomerate newspapers. They're also controlling the magazine industry and the so-called, the so-called news magazines, and putting out exactly what they want, and even going so far as, with the case of Wasson, to even start the psychedelic movement, starting the whole craze of magic mushrooms in 1957. And Henry Luce's wife even brags about Henry Luce doing more to popularize LSD than Timothy Leary did. So all of this stuff is going back into the control over the media. And then what they do, like, you know, they control these 25, and then all of these other smaller satellite papers are sort of neglected or pushed aside or eaten up because they don't tote the line.
I'm confused, John. Hold on a second. Are you talking about C.D. Jackson, like Charles D. Jackson, the guy who worked with William Paley of CBS during World War II and psychological warfare operations?
Yeah, and the same guy who's there at Buchenwald holding up the pelvis bone and showing the lamps and all that stuff. That guy, yes.
Yeah, just a comment on the irony how during wartime these guys are psychological warfare. William Paley from CBS, Charles Jackson of Time Life, Fortune magazine, right? But during peacetime, they're writing your everyday media so you can get educated, right? But they're psychological warfare officers. But they're our friends.
Sure.
They're
yeah, it's absolute irony that these guys who are in charge of warfare against the so-called enemy are employed against us during peacetime. You know, manipulating the and herding the crowd, so to speak, in the direction that these elitists want. And yeah, it's disgusting. It went on at Buchenwald with C.D. Jackson, and it went on many other places as well.
Well, I just find it ironic that someone who's in psychological warfare during World War II, like C.D. Jackson, then afterwards, like, he works at Fortune magazine, he works for Eisenhower in charge of special operations and psychological warfare, and then all of a sudden, Henry Lewis, a skull and bones guy who owns Time, is like, hey, C.D. Jackson, why don't you run our magazine? Like, what are the qualifications to run a national magazine, if not psychological warfare? It's all right there.
Exactly, and an expertise in knowledge of the trivium and quadrivium. I mentioned this guy, Gordon Wasson, a minute ago. He was the PR vice president for J.P. Morgan Bank, and this guy was really in charge of creating ways to sell the banking empire and the
Who needs to be sold on money? Why would J.P. Morgan, a big bank who started out by selling corrupt guns,
Now Gordon Wasson earned his way to the vice presidency of J.P. Morgan Bank by writing a hit piece on that story. So, I mean, you know, there's claims out there that that story is false now that were written by J.P. Morgan's own vice presidents who had an agenda to get promoted for writing that. So you can't use that as evidence.
That's called the Hull Carbine Affair. For those of you playing at home, it's listed in the episode notes.
Well, let's not forget that Charles Douglas Jackson was also responsible for bringing the Bilderberg Group to America and ensuring the participation in America. And I would add to that that C.D. Jackson's counterpart in England was a philosopher at the London School of Economics. And him, as well as Hedley Bull and Herbert Butterfield and others, are responsible for the ideology of liberal realism. And this goes into how international relations is created as an academic overlay for agendas. So they're able to establish liberal realism at the London School of Economics. Of course, Fabian founded, and then they have ideas that counter that with the American establishment, with the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, that's
now,
that London School of Economics thing that you're talking about, that was founded by the Rothschild family, a big banking family, who also funded the Economist magazine and Roll Call and Congressional Quarterly. Those are the magazines used by our Congress to make their decisions and get their information. So what I'm detecting is that these banker elite managerial types have created echelons and layers to manage us through the use of words, specifically in popular mass media, that they seem to control and then make us buy it. That's crazy that people pay for that, right?
I just wanted to mention on good old C.D. Jackson that I also believe he was responsible for the War of the Worlds propaganda broadcast with Orson Welles, and that was through, I believe, one of the Rockefeller Foundations or Tavistock. Indirectly funding it, but that was essentially the first test of mass media pulling a fast one on the newly uneducated public to gauge their reaction and see if enabled them to pull one over with like things like Pearl Harbor, Gulf of Tonkin.
Sounds like psychological warfare.
9/11.
Are you saying, Paul, that C.D. Jackson, the same guy who was involved in psychological warfare with the U.S. government, is the same guy who is behind War of the Worlds and promoting the whole UFO agenda, as well as promoting through Gordon Wasson the psychedelic and MK Ultra agenda, which plays out today in things like the New Age movement and 2012 crowd?
Directly or indirectly, yeah, there's some involvement in a variety of those subjects, but I know from, it was the Phenomenon series, which you can find on YouTube, and they had an episode, I believe, on the money masters or the basically the banksters, and it talked about C.D. Jackson funding Orson Welles to go on the national radio and do this version of a reading of H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds as if it was actually happening live.
Right.
H.G. Wells was a Fabian socialist.
Exactly. H.G. Yes, Wells, of course, you know, wrote the New World Order and several other books that tie into this agenda. But so, you know, it could have just been for its fantastical element, you know, the fact that they know that there are no aliens, or if they wanted to acclimatize the public to aliens. But personally, I think it was just a test to see what the reaction would be, as often psychological warfare is. And the fact that millions of people poured out onto the streets, the elitists or the Fabian socialists said, all right, I think they're primed and ready.
So it was it was kind of like the artistic application of all of these psychological principles that they had institutionalized in the years just before. And what you're mentioning, they were all part of the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, or SHAEF, and that was part of the Psychological Warfare Division and the OSS, as well as the U.S. United States Office of War Information. I had a couple other points and bits of evidence to follow up with here, dovetailing on kind of what Paul had mentioned earlier with the Rhodes Scholars. I have a book here entitled Globalizing Ideal Beauty, How Female Copywriters of the J. Walter Thompson Agency Redefined Beauty for the 20th Century by Denise H. Sutton. And in this book, it's describing, let me give a little bit of background, the James Walter Thompson Company is where John B. Watson, the founder of behaviorism from the University of Chicago and Johns Hopkins University, was employed. And the James Walter Thompson Company was the broker for the De Beers Diamond Cartel in the Diamond Trading Company. Now, this is very succinct.
Hey, now you're not talking about the De Beers Diamond Company and that's connected through Cecil Rhodes and Africa and
Oppenheimer.
The royal family of Belgium that ties directly to Charlotte Iserbeet's husband, are you?
That very well could be the case. I'd like to see expanded evidence on that. On page 137 on
Charlotte Iserbeet's husband was one of the key people for that. Yeah. All right. Sorry.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you can look at All Watched Over by Machines of Love and Grace Part 3 and see how the Belgian government was using the plight of the Africans and all of that. But I want to mention dovetailing or following up on what I was saying with John B. Watson and the James Walter Thompson Company and how they were the brokers for or the advertising agency for the Diamond Trading Cartel. It states, long before JWT established itself in Mexico, it had been recruiting a certain type of man and woman to work in its international offices. Starting as early as 1927, Sam Meek drew on the waves of youth coming out of Cambridge and Oxford, including Rhodes Scholars such as James Hamilton Russell, who was hired by JWT and went on to direct the JWT office in South Africa. Rhodes Scholars were often chose to work in JWT offices in their home country and helped in the expansion of JWT internationally. Meek was able to attract leading British academics, journalists, and occasionally members of nobility. Basil Nicholson, one of the founders of the London Daily Mirror, worked at JWT as well as Lady Elizabeth Pelham, daughter of the Earl of Chichester. Pelham worked on the Lux account in London, where she also spent time in the department store demonstrating the product by washing and ironing clothes and talking to customers. Meek felt that JWT was a company of scholars, adventurers, and voyagers, though what seems to be apparent is that these scholars, adventurers, and voyagers had to have had a common experience regarding class position and race. Pulling recruits from the Rhodes Scholar program and elite institutions ensured this commonality. As a result, even by 1959, American and British men continue to hold leading roles for JWT internationally. So I think that's a very good piece of evidence to what you were saying, how these Rhodes Scholars are leveraged worldwide.
It's like advertising is psychological warfare almost.
Absolutely. And the other point I wanted to bring up was in relation to what Richard mentioned and the evolution of this through cybernetics. What I see here is a continuation that Gatto is describing from pragmatism, and I've got this article here entitled Cultural New Deal, Urge to Bring Order, which is an article about Lawrence K. Frank, who was the head of the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation with Frank Friedmont Smith, orchestrated the Macy conferences. If you're familiar with the Net documentary by Lutz Dambeck.
I was going to say, just summarize the Macy conferences. What were they? What was the goal in Macy conferences? What were they trying to do, Kev?
Well, there were many different agendas day by day, but they were instrumental in the use of LSD as a mind-expanding substance to create an open system and kind of a organic or applied to social systems version of cybernetics. And that's what I take out of it the most. And Lawrence K. Frank was a director. And I think this article, if it's okay that I read, I think this article on Lawrence K. Frank gives a very good summation of the idea of pragmatism plus cybernetics. It's called Cultural New Deal, Urge to Bring Order. And it's out of the Science Newsletter, January 6, 1940. And it says, a new way of looking at the universe and man's place in it was urged upon the scientific world by Lawrence K. Frank of the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, New York, before the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Such a cultural new deal is needed to bring order into our society and our personal lives. Until we have such a new formulation of our motivating ideas, we must continue to live anxiously and contingently, he contended. Mr. Frank, considering the essential concepts and beliefs that make up what we call, quote-unquote, culture finds that recent scientific knowledge has not been utilized adequately in shaping our motivational ideas suitable for living in a dynamic, changing world. Now, he says four great problems that men of all times have had to face that need new interpretation, in his opinion, are, number one, how the universe arose or how it was created, how it operates, who and what makes things happen and why. Number two, man's origin, nature and destiny, his relation to the world and whether or not he is a part of nature or outside of it. Number three, the relation of the individual to the group, who must be sacrificed for whom, and the individual's rights and obligations. Number four, what man wants and what he should have, human nature, human conduct, human motives. Now he should be educated and made part of the community. There's that adjustment function. Science has given new answers to all of these problems in recent years, but most of the people do not know them, and those that do know often do not feel them. For this reason, Mr. Frank considers the rebuilding of our culture the most insistent task before us. And this is his quote. The task of constructing a new framework of concepts and beliefs to give order, meaning, and significance to life becomes ever more insistent, he said. But it must be clearly recognized that this is essentially an artistic task of creating a consistent picture of the universe and of man that will not only satisfy our new criteria of credibility, but also express the new aspirations and sensibilities through which we seek to attain the enduring human values. Mr. Frank predicted that in the coming years, the discovery of the origins of man and man's development of culture will be recognized as the greatest of discoveries. So it's an artistic vision to create a sense or a picture of consistency.
So what you're talking about is humans discussing how to use other human beings, right?
Yes, indeed.
So that brings us back to a short summary in which I'm going to add the idea that William T. Stead, it's spelled S-T-E-A-D, who Gatto remembers from being immortalized or mythologized in the show The Avengers, William T. Stead actually invented the thing that we know as the interview. He interviewed this guy called General Gordon back in, I think, 1890. It's in the footnotes for the film. But the point is that through this interview process, they were able to present this new layer of propaganda to the public that seemed so real, right? And William T. Stead was then later the executor over the Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes. Now, that's a book edited by William T. Stead, and it's linked in the episode notes. It's highly interesting because it actually spells out the use of the gold and diamonds from the De Beers cartel, which was set up by Cecil John Rhodes, and his express wish to set up a secret society based on the Jesuits for the purpose of British Empire domination of the planet, to be used, in part to create these scholarships, Rhodes scholarships, through Oxford, and to create an Oxford roundtable of people who were of this upper nobility of management class, who would then create policy and enact it in the United States, for instance, through the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, you want the details on this, because this is not what they taught us in public school, right? So the reason that we took the name Tragedy and Hope for our website, where we're trying to bring all this information together and help to educate ourselves and the public, is due to the fact that there was a 1966 book that was subsequently destroyed. And so it's very hard to get your hands on until recently when it's been republished, called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And it was written by someone who had access for 20 years to the Council on Foreign Relations records and was invited to write an official history of the real history of America. Tragedy and Hope was written by Professor Carol Quigley, then of Georgetown University. He had also taught at Princeton and Harvard, so he's very much an establishment academic professor. But his books, if you read what he was teaching, his first book, Evolution of Civilizations, shows you this step-by-step pattern that keeps repeating through history. This is how civilizations rise. This is how they get corrupt. This is how they eat themselves. This is how it moves on to another civilization, right? His next book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Times, about a 1,300-page book that contains bit by bit, here's all the history, here's all the facts, here's everything. As Gatto says, here's every conspiracy you've ever heard of, only it's not a conspiracy. It's the date and the time and the facts and this and that, right? Quigley's next book was The Anglo-American Establishment, which he wrote in 1948 but wasn't published until after his death in 1981 because of the fact that it's such a succinct and eloquent expression of the summary of Tragedy and Hope. By Gatto's recollection, it's a little bit beyond the ability of an average person to grasp it without the help of a teacher or tutor or somebody who's familiar with the bigger story contained in Tragedy and Hope. But when you break it down, it goes back to the essence of world militarization today, for instance, is this whole thing that's been going on in the Middle East, this struggle for peace in the Middle East, which has gone on since 1919 and is subsequent, it's a consequence of the Balfour Declaration, which was managed by the Rhodes Roundtable out of Oxford University. Balfour was someone who was working as an agent for the Rothschild banking family. So there's a lot of interesting history in here that is not conspiracy. You can pick up Margaret Macmillan's Paris 1919. She is the great-granddaughter of David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Britain during World War I. She is using the archives of David Lloyd George, Arthur Balfour, Alfred Milner, and all these other people who were participating in the Rhodes Roundtable, which, again, is a function of the De Beers diamond cartel and gold mining, which, again, is a function of the Rothschild banking family, because Rhodes left his will. His third will was to leave everything to Lord Rothschild, because that's where he had gotten his funding in the first place. So this idea that Gatto brings up in hour two about his roommate, Eddie Epstein, who had written about the diamond cartel and was invited down to South Africa and had said that they have a diamond supply that'll last thousands of years and therefore diamonds are worthless, right? This is also in a Peace Revolution episode, Diamonds, the Jewel of Denial. And so what Gatto is doing is actually bringing a lot of past Peace Revolution episodes, past Gnostic Media episodes, into a contextual framework where now you can see it in its full fabric of history. And here's what's going on. These people exist. They are predators to other human beings. They see that they say we're irrational, have justified themselves philosophically so they can either treat us as cattle, as livestock, as pests, as any of these things, right? And so it's our job as adult human beings who recognize our natural predators and to share this information amongst ourselves so we can learn to protect each other as well as ourselves. And with that, we will move on to minutes 30 through 45 of Hour 3 of the Ultimate History Lesson. We'll be right back.
That there was no ability on the part of any potential enemy to sustain a war, that all the gains would be right away, then they couldn't replace their losses. I noted that Quigley said, not only did the British start the war with a larger air force than the Germans and more advanced technologically, but they could replace their losses and the Germans couldn't and the Japs couldn't at all. So they ended the war with the same plane they began the war with. Well, this was understood before we had a war. This is a good way to get out of the depression. Good way to cow dissidents in the population always is to declare a national emergency. Then you have an excuse for foreclosing freedom of speech.
What did Quigley do that was so unique or remarkable that no one else had done before?
Well, what Carol Quigley, the head of the Foreign Service Department at Georgetown University, no marginal school. What he did was use his invitation to be the only human being ever invited to view the files of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I believe its predecessor also. What he did was to actually write a major piece of nonfiction. It must be 1,300 words long, pages long. Fairly small print, and he made the fatal mistake of being a superb writer and thinker so that it's accessible to anyone who gets a hold of a copy of the book. That was quite impossible beginning 6 months after the book was published, and I can just see the manuscript must have been this big. So an editor asked to vet the thing and make sure, yeah. And after all, Georgetown, this guy's safe. Out it goes. Macmillan publishes it. Sells out instantly. And any conspiracy theory you've ever heard of is documented, only not as a conspiracy theory. Gives you the name, the date, the time, the actual letters. Oh, good God. Well, somebody got hung for that. Macmillan broke the plates, told Quigley there was no interest in the book at all, broke the plate so it couldn't be reprinted. Quigley's on a tape recording right at the end of his life that's stored down in Georgetown in the stacks, saying that they lied to him, that they had tons of, who wouldn't want to read the book? I spent 6 months looking for a copy of the book and finally found one in the rare book room at New York University and had it stolen. And then a couple of months later, because I'd looked in so many cities, I got a call, mysterious call from a fellow. I think he turned out to be a dentist, had a radio show.
Who is?
Okay.
It's Stan Monteith.
Yes, Stan Monteith. He said, I understand you're looking for, well, I said, do you know where? Yes, he said, I have some copies. Of course, he had reprinted the copies. And after Monteith, over the next couple of years, several other people had taken the Macmillan and reprinted it so much, in fact, that it became the basis for a growing number of aware people. They weren't sure what they were aware of, other than that the story was not as delivered, not in junior high and not at Harvard. It was a different story. It was a story that could accommodate two fraternity brothers at Yale running against one another for president. The big agenda. But Quigley's real gift to the rest of us is his absolute mastery of prose and his really interesting mind and his confession that he agreed with the plot. He simply, as a good Roman Catholic, didn't apply it with the secrecy. He said, I believe there's nothing anyone can do about this anyway. It was marvelous. I'd go back whenever I feel despair. And not an easy, I mean, it's an easy read because it's so well written, but it's a big chunk. He says, for example, that the only times liberties ever appeared in human society is when the population is privately armed with deadly weapons. And to reach the acme of liberty, they have to have the same weapons available to them that the government has available to them. And yet we're not talking about some guy who rolls his collar up. We're talking about this internationally famous scholar. So,
well, at the beginning, you know, the American Revolution, the people who were fighting against the British government had equal arms. You know, they were landowners. They had interest to fight over it. That stopped being equal in the 1930s with mechanized warfare and mass production because they've had Prussian education in place for 80 years and now everyone's an obedient worker, and Amtssprache allows a lot of people to do things that they normally wouldn't do, but now it's part of their job and now it's their responsibility and now it's their duty, and all the things that Milgram drove home through his experiments. Look, these people will kill other people if you put a white coat on.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's quite exciting. I mean, it's a hideous turn in human history, but it's quite exciting. The comprehensive surveillance mechanism prevents local groups from developing armament. These Arabs have done the only thing of which there isn't a successful defense, and that's to blow, just what the Japs did at the end of World War II, to blow themselves up, to blow babies up, to blow, not women very often, but still they're beginning to appear as human weapons. What you can do is suppress that activity, but you can't do it and say, this is a free society and we're all in the game together.
There are four copies, I think, of Tragedy and Hope around. Have you seen the first edition?
I have, and I'm wondering when Macmillan has been forced to reprint it very recently, in the last year or two. And I'm wondering, you only have to delete key sections, still be a big book, to take the real sting out of it. I thought somebody with young eyes, a lot of stamina, ought to sit with the original edition and the reprint just to make sure.
So we're doing tomorrow afternoon. We have a first edition and we have several other reprints and we're going to...
Oh, do let me know. Because I have other people I'm trying to see the idea, and I could say there's the project's underway. I want you to send them a little check. And, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about Quigley's book, Anglo-American Establishment?
I was impressed by the thinking and the scholarship, but I think the presentation puts it beyond the reach, not beyond the understanding, but beyond the reach of ordinary people without a coach. And I do think we have a pressing need to find, without diluting the complexity, to find the idiom. I think I said to Rich earlier, it drives me insane. There are things I've been rewriting for years because I'll try them out and I'll feel that an audience misses how that plugs in.
It's almost as if the audience needs a little bit of, you know, re-inspiring their curiosity, but then giving them a methodology by which they can start to reignite their learning. Once they bring their attention and consciousness up a little bit, then they can receive some of these other messages.
Yes.
In the meantime, we can be coaches and help them kind of get that.
We mentioned this earlier, but the great favor Charles Darwin did for people like me is to indict the Irish as hopeless biology, because my audiences are full of Irishers, and I say, don't trust an old broken down school teacher. Pick the book up and go to the Irish sections, because it's unmistakable his scorn and contempt to dismiss them as irredeemable. The Spanish is irredeemable. There's quite a little catalog of people, not Swedish blondes, mind you.
No, Darwin does that because instead of observing how things actually work, they were trying to carry out an agenda. So he creates these ideas, and he said, under these ideas, you people can do what you want, and it's going to make them hopeless. And if you think you're hopeless, then you're not really aspiring to climb up any ladder, because there's no ladder, because you've been told you're hopeless.
Right.
And he gets them to basically self-amputate their curiosity, and then they bring in compulsory schooling, and that cauterizes the whole thing. And they're like, well, you won't be curious anymore asking questions.
I think Darwin himself had a lot of, he's not innocent, but he had a lot of innocence in his character. Galton has none. Galton knows exactly where to drop these things to cause maximum damage and to institutionalize the anti-educational nature of school. Once it's institutionalized, nobody has to know what's going on. That's the way you make your living. And if you were, for example, to extend the privileges of partial autonomy among school kids, you would shrink the establishment. And that is no way to retain power or income. If you were to find substitutions for the purchased supposed improvements in curriculum, I mean, the truth is, superb education doesn't cost a penny to deliver. If you understand what it is, what you're aiming for, and what you can use, it's a lot easier if you have if you have money. But what money's usually used for is to purchase layer after layer of interventions, and those interventions prevent the educational result.
Compare and contrast how Adam Smith felt about money and the earning of it to sustain oneself versus today, where it's just earned to buy more and compulsory, you know, status, what do you say, so status symbols, you know, conspicuous consumption, these ideas.
I must tell you, I used to be enough of a favorite at the Cato Institute that I was named the Secretary of Education in their shadow cabinet. That has to be, oh, that's when, did you know Marshall Fritz?
No, I don't know
Marshall. Okay, he was a legendary member. When I discovered what Adam Smith actually said, which I wouldn't deny that key people at Cato also know, I became very, very problematical because in Theory of Moral Sentiments, Smith, so I'm going to give a shorthand here. Smith says that to spend your time making money as a mark of insanity, and what it will buy you is a bad life. But we should be grateful to the people who do that because they assemble capital. They pay the biggest price, and they create, you know, improvements for everybody else. I don't think the religion of libertarian capitalism wishes that complication to be well understood, because there's no way to explain it away. He just as he's very clear that the peasant's son and the duke's son are the same people. He's very, very clear. You got to be nuts to assemble capital.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution. That was minutes 30 through 45. And starting out with the British versus Germany in World War II, he's saying that Germany and Japan and the Axis powers, basically, they can start the fight, but they can't replenish their supplies. So, and then he starts pointing to Quigley in the 1976 interview with Quigley, which was also an earlier Peace Revolution podcast episode, wherein Quigley tells you how his book was destroyed and suppressed and how he was lied to by the establishment. So he came to his own little wake up and realizations post-publication of Tragedy and Hope. And that just shows that, you know, before the internet, if you wanted to find a book that was out of print and purposely not anywhere to be found, it took John, who's I would assume a pretty astute researcher, 6 months to find a copy. He says he took it from that library. I also know that he returned it, so that shows a little bit of his character. He's willing to take it to get the information, copy it, but he also has someone put it back, so I think that says a lot about him. But what he's relating is that it's a different version of history. It's a different story than we're being taught as the version of history that we all live and act under and you know, make our decisions under every day. I'm not sure what that means to the future of America if only a small number of people actually get to know themselves and understand the history, but I think it's about time for us to make Tragedy and Hope a more popular word, because what it's referring to is this treasure trove of information that has been assembled, and it wasn't assembled for you, but you might find it to be very useful indeed. When we go to wrap up this 15-minute segment, I have several pieces I want to read out of Anglo-American Establishment Tragedy and Hope just to help build out the context. But we'll save that for right before we do the break. And then his observation about the Arab suicide bombers, that ties back to the roundtable, Arthur Balfour, Alfred Milner, that whole sort of thing that kicked off almost 100 years ago. It also shows the limitations of John's ability to continue to do and refine the research based on we're all surrounded by this propaganda. So if you're not actually looking at these things for yourself, you're not going to discover it's not Arab suicide bombers, but rather it's false flag attacks that these duped are given explosive devices and directed by intelligence authorities to do these things so that they can have controlled conflicts where there's no unknowns, where they're in complete control the whole time and there's no real enemy, because they go out and create their own enemy to fight. And that's how they're able to propagate this Prussian militarized society that we now know as America. So, you know, it also brought up the point that if you think you're helpless, it paralyzes you. And this is something that Galton is using to do maximum damage through the institutionalization of his eugenics theory within our school system. And the reason that we're going to school isn't because we need an education, because as Gatto points out, a superb education doesn't cost a penny. But yet we've been conditioned to believe that our path to success lays at the other end of purchasing layer after layer after layer of abstraction from artificial teachers, which actually prevents the educational process from taking place from within.
I concur with your assessment of Quigley's work. It kind of covers, it's almost like he's taking a macroscopic view and an increasingly microscopic view of these timelines and trying to show these different patterns in history and how they repeat and how they're used by the, whether you want to call them the elite or shamanic or priestly or predatory class, who I'm sure have the noblest of intentions behind their noble lies, but, you know, the trickle-down effect is that it, you know, sucks our energy away and reorganizes that energy to be used against us. And I think it's interesting, the major note I had was about Darwin and Galton and essentially this idea of eugenicists and just science in general providing further supposedly objective truths which are really used as justified sins in terms of having this idea of evolution but only for certain people on the planet and just a reflection of the paranoia that people who have lots to lose eventually gain. They gain this paranoia because they themselves have become irrational from not having anyone there to say no. And so they either fund or come up with or follow these operating systems for genocide.
To just interject on your comment real quick, add a little color to it. I remember some irony coming across when I was reading through Descent of Man. And Darwin's, you know, he's traveling the world. He's on this ship. And after a while, he, in his words, he has relations with a slave girl on the ship who is of African descent. And he remarks about how she has similar capabilities to him. And he can almost relate to her as an equal person, right? And so there's so much irony in the irrationality being expressed that they're above these other species, but they can recognize themselves in the species. Like, he's just constantly contradicting himself all the way through. And so I think if you just actually dig in and read Descent of Man, whether it's the chapter on the Irish, I think it was chapter 3 or 4, or the chapter about where he's, you know, taking people against their will. Because if you're on a slave ship, you're a slave. And if Darwin's having sex with you, that's not from your consent. That's because you're in proximity to him and a bunch of other men that are on the ship. So I just see that when you read into it, it's not what we've been presented as is Darwin, origin of species, evolution, etc. He doesn't even talk about human evolution and the origin of species. It's all in the Descent of Man. And when you read that, it's an irrational racist's rantings. But I digress.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it seems like as this new era of common sense and, you know, quote unquote, enlightened thinking was rising up or beginning to rise up, that at the same time, there's these increased philosophies that were kind of holding on to the irrationality and trying to leverage people's energy towards, yeah, anything like racist eugenics policy, slavery, anything that could keep essentially these profit models going, right? So it's interesting to see the layers where there's like, there's the theoretical application with this idea and then the practical application in the forms of the different types of slavery that it imposes or helps reinforce, and then see how over the last 100 years that's transferred to less of a physical slavery and more of a mental slavery, because we can all just tune into our propaganda box and it gives us our orders, instructions, tastes, habits, and they don't have to do as much work.
Very well said. Kevin?
Yeah, I think you guys covered a lot of the really good points for this section on Carol Quigley, how he mentioned that there was a comprehensive surveillance mechanism that prevents the people from obtaining armaments. And this goes back to the idea of the panopticon or the panopticon singularity, when you allow automation and technology to replace human consciousness. So I thought that was really interesting. There are many facts surrounding Carol Quigley's tenure at Georgetown University. He was, in fact, the person that instructed or helped Bill Clinton obtain his Rhodes Scholarship. And there is a book that I can pull up for reference in the notes where there's an account of Bill Clinton become running for class president. And at the time that he was doing this, Georgetown University was in the process of unifying the four different schools. They had the School of Foreign Services, and they were bringing all of these together. And it was much opposed by the students at the time.
Well, that School of Foreign Services, would that have anything to do with the Carnegie plan to have take over the power of diplomatic machinery in this country?
And Edmund Walsh and, yeah.
Well, yeah. Edmund Walsh, Center for Foreign Services, isn't that where Quigley taught at Georgetown?
I do believe so. And what happened was when Bill Clinton was running for class president, the class body at the time did not want to unify these schools, and the Jesuit administration did. And Bill Clinton took the unpopular siding with the Jesuit administration and then secured his Rhodes Scholarship with the help of Quigley. So it's interesting that he went to school, and at the time that, you know, Bill Clinton was his student, Quigley was in the process of getting ready to publish Tragedy and Hope. So he knows at this period of time that there are these different paths of power that are contradictory to what the majority of Americans, especially, I mean, and certainly the Americans in his home state, saw as the lineage of this country. And he chose to join that ruling class rather than to act against it.
Well, since you brought up the J word, let's talk about the Jesuits for a minute, because Quigley, on page 34 of the Anglo-American Establishment, a page I'd already marked before you had brought that up anyway. This is what I was going to read. To create a secret society patterned on the Jesuits, the reference to the Jesuits as for the model of his secret society can be found in a confession of faith which Rhodes had written 2 years earlier in 1875 and which he enclosed in his will. 13 years later, in a letter to the trustee of his third will, Rhodes told him how to form the secret society, saying, "In considering the questions suggested, take the constitution of the Jesuits, if obtainable, and insert English Empire for Roman Catholic religion." So he's just doing a find and replace, basically, on their document to make his document. That's pretty smart. It, later on the page, is talking about the sole trustee, Lord Rothschild, and William T. Steed. Later in that paragraph, it talks about Dr. Frank Adeolette, who Kevin mentioned, I remember, in hour two. Frank Adeolette, Dr. Frank Adeolette, is the best-known American authority on Rhodes' wills, claims that Rhodes made no reference to the secret society in his last two wills because he had abandoned the idea. Well, shame for Mr. Adeolette. We have history to show us all the evidentiary facts that his will was, in fact, carried out, that a round table was created, that it's run out of All Souls College at Oxford, that they have meetings, they have publications, that there are documents, there are archives, that we have all of this in our possession. So Mr. Adeolette's assertion that no such thing was carried out afterwards is superseded by this History of the Rhodes Trust by Sir Anthony Kenny, which I just happen to have here. And on page 514, to answer this question, we need to know what his ambitions were. In his fourth will of 1888, Rhodes left most of his fortune to Lord Rothschild and urged him to use it to found a secret society with a constitution modeled on that of the Jesuits, but with the words English Empire substituted for every occurrence of the words Roman Catholic Church. So the question is, why is Sir Anthony Kenny, a pro-vice chancellor of development at the University of Oxford, repeating these words written by Carol Quigley, written in 1948, if it's not accurate of what's going on? So what you have are from a myriad of sources that Cecil Rhodes existed, that he built the De Beers Diamond and Gold Cartel, that was funded by a Rothschild banking family empire, that he left a will to create a secret society based on the Jesuits, and that this secret society in America is in the form of Council on Foreign Relations and the American Historical Association and all these other things that are controlling our education system, including the Carnegie Endowment, Rockefeller Foundation, and Ford Foundation. These are all listed throughout the books. So let's go to page 951 of Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time from 1966, and see what Carol Quigley has to say about this. He says, in fact, this network, which we may identify as the Roundtable Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and it frequently does so. I know of operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or most of its aims, and I have throughout much of my life been close to it and many of its instruments. I have objected, both in the past and recently, to a few of its policies, notably its belief that England was an Atlantic rather than European power and must be allied or even federated with the United States and must remain isolated from Europe. But in general, My chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. He then goes on to talk about Lord Milner, who played a role in the Balfour Declaration, William T. Stead, Walter Lippmann, Frank Adiolette, the Round Table, Milner's Kindergarten, J.P. Morgan, Carnegie Endowment, Rockefeller, Whitney Families. I mean, this is all just in two pages right here. And on page 953, the Round Table Group's chief Oxford headquarters, All Souls College. And then it ties into John von Neumann on these other cybernetics, Macy conference type people. So the point is, these are dots, and when you connect these dots, you get an actual picture of the actual history of the metaphor that controls all of us. And I just find it ironic that the words tragedy and hope seem to be lost on the American population, and if we can do anything about that, it will be to reverse that effect. Because without it, it's tragedy, and with this information, that is our only hope. Anyone have any other feedback? Words of encouragement?
In relation to Martin Luther and Every Man is Priest, there was also a whole other set of ideas coming over, and I would urge people to look into a book set. It's a five-volume set edited by James Good called The Early American Reception of German Idealism. It's pretty expensive, so I would seek out some of the individual books that you can find for free on archive.org. But on the book's summary here, it says, many people say that the mid-19th century of American philosophy was homegrown and uninfluenced by European ideas. But in fact, there was an active group of American writers of the period whose outlook was cosmopolitan. They were well aware of the philosophical revolution that occurred in German idealism around 1800, and they sought to transplant it on American soil. In time, idealism would become an important force in American philosophy, but the writings of these early pioneers have been largely forgotten. Tomes Press presents a collection of five of the most interesting and influential of these books. The set opens with Friedrich Rausch's Psychology from 1841, which was the first statement of Hegelian psychology in the English language. Volume 2 is The Remains of Reverend James Marsh, 1843, and it's a work that sparked the New England Transcendentalist interest in German philosophy and was studied by a young John Dewey. Next comes Friedrich Hedges, Prose Writers in Germany, which is a book that introduced many Americans to German idealism, including H.C. Brookmeyer of the St. Louis School. Volume 4 is Lauren T. Hickok's Massive Rational Psychology from 1849, in which he presented the first study of Kantian philosophy of mind in the New World. The final volume is Charles C. Everett's The Science of Thought from 1869, and it is the earliest attempt to articulate Hegelian logic outside of Europe. Despite these large influences, these books have all become extremely rare, and the historians of thought would be pleased to, you know, find these books. So I recommend that people kind of search these out, because I was able to get a hold of Friedrich Rausch's Psychology, which has a subtitle of, you know, Or a View of the Human Soul, as well as Prose Writers of Germany, which includes all of the original writings translated into English for the first time, of Johann Fichte, Pestalozzi, Johann Caspar Lavater.
Well, Hegel. Tie that to Wundt right there, because it's about the soul, and these guys believe that human beings that are irrational have no soul, and therefore we can all be controlled without them feeling guilty about controlling us, right? So
that's
Wundt, what's Wundt's position on soul?
Well, Wundt's position on the soul is that we have none. It's as simple as that.
Last but not least, a couple other notable names that you might want to check in the episode notes are Thorsten Veblen, and this idea of conspicuous consumption, the spending of our hard-earned money for artifacts not based on need of their form and function, but of the status value that is brought by having these tools and trinkets. Vilfredo Pareto and Gaetan Mosca. So Pareto, P-A-R-E-T-O, and Mosca, M-O-S-C-A. That has everything to do with the idea of a managerial class as defined by Pareto and Mosca, and there are the elite, aristocratic, managerial class, and Pareto and Mosca defined this back in the 1800s, and the difference between them and us is that they are organized, they have plans, and they execute on getting things done, and we are all unorganized and slowly just realizing this and have yet to get anything real done until we all are on the same page. So with that, we're going to go to minutes 45 through 60. Of the third hour, the ultimate history lesson. We'll be right back.
What lessons can be learned from Ben Franklin?
Yeah, Franklin's life is the best lesson. Franklin was such, I almost slipped into Pittsburgh profanity, but I won't. Franklin was not a morally nice human being in any way. In fact, his son broke off contact with him and never spoke to him again for 40 years for the rest of their life. So Franklin was the ultimate pragmatist. He masqueraded as a Quaker, even though he had no ties whatsoever. The French who financed the revolution talked about this marvelous Quaker. I mean, he was like a national sensation over there. And he didn't disguise in his dress. I mean, he camouflaged himself sort of. He always walked a line where he could justify what he was doing. But his life is evidence from a huge, they're probably a lower middle class family, a candle maker. They always had food on the table. But his autobiography is worth its weight in gold many times. Because he explains how you can introduce the highest level curriculum imaginable to 10, 11-year-old people that his father, who had no touch with, you know, scholastic theory, would bring in every night a stranger from the street, set an extra place at table so that the, you know, in-house culture could be infused with fresh input there. That he and his friends decided that without mastering high-level written prose, their opportunity, I mean, he's 11 years old, and they say, how are we going to get a big-time literary style when nobody, you know, they take the New Yorker magazine of the day, The Tatler and the Spectator, written read by only the most hoity-toity, and they rewrote the articles in their own words and then would present the rewrite to strangers and say, pardon me, sir, could you tell me where this article might have come from? And when everyone said, oh, that's Tatler or Spectator, they knew they had mastered that. Come on, they wouldn't do that at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. These are 11, 12-year-old boys. And he's doing it while he's working a 60-hour week at labor. And he's putting capital aside for his own business by selling beer to the printers at their lunch hour. How does he get to do that? Goes to the owner of the print shop and he says, look, you're letting these guys go for lunch. Some of them are coming back woozy. Some of them are not coming back at all. Let me bring the buckets of beer in, make a penny, and they'll be chained to the machine. That's Ben Franklin, mind you. So his accomplishments, I mean, he's the reason we have a post office. He's the reason there's a University of Pennsylvania. He's probably the reason the German isn't a coeval in Pennsylvania, because all these little German potus groups were not speaking English any more than, you know, they could get by with. And he found ways to put political pressure and penalties on them if their kids weren't surrendered to English training. Now, he's a miraculous example of what nobody can do if they know what to do and have some discipline, mind you. I would say nobody should not read Franklin's autobiography very, very slowly. Do not read it for the story, but for the details. And you have a formula that anybody could use. So there's for Ben Franklin.
What could a student learn from the life experiences, young life experiences of Thomas Edison?
Well, Mr. Edison, from New Jersey, begged his mother not to waste his time sending him to school. This before he was 12 years old, and to allow him to go west where during the Civil War, where opportunity was burgeoning. And she let him do it 1,000 miles from home. He became a train boy. That's the lowest job imaginable. You know, at whistle stops, you go out and buy sodas or coffee. You know, you're everybody's factotum. But he talked the train into letting him put a broken down printing press in the boxcar. And then during the Civil War, because he was able to connect things into new realities, he knew that the train stations got Civil War news at the same time the newspapers did. But the newspapers didn't come out to certain hours. He used his printing press to run current Civil War news instead of auctioning off children at the whistle stops. He sold the Grand Trunk Herald. And because he wasn't the nicest guy in the world, he varied the price from a nickel to a quarter, depending on what the audience could pay. He put together a substantial stake that founded his own. Plus, he used the stake in the years he was doing this to start 3 businesses, each one of which depended on the advantage he had by going up and down the Michigan length there. Now, let me see. I'm years away from one of them. One of them was that he could distribute magazines and newspapers free. He'd just pick them up at some drop point, and he could put anyone out of business because he didn't really have to charge much to do that. There were a couple of others. I think one was a food business, so that when he ran out to get something for the passengers, he was the owner of the business. And there was a third one. He, of course, has 1,007 patents without a day in college. In fact, when he founded GE, it wasn't called GE, but that's what it became, he made the test for hiring executive staff so hard that he used to laugh and say nobody with a college degree can pass this test. Now notice if all of this documented history was, and it's your birthright, if this were shared with you in third grade and fourth grade and fifth grade, notice that you would arrive at the age of 12 with a whole different idea of what your prospects were, rather than your hand shaking because you got a C on your report card, and that probably would doom your career. It's a colossal crime, and I'm speaking now as a detective story fan. I'm staying away from the moral high ground here because it's so far beyond what we define as good and evil. And for the people who do this, it is good because as Darwin's Malthus, as Thomas Malthus says clearly in his essay, Climbing the Mountain, the high ground, the moral mountain. He says it's a kindness. These people are doomed to such miserable lives that to hasten their demise is a great kindness to them. You work them to death, you starve them. You're doing God's work. He, of course, was a parson of the Church of England, which Charles was trained to be, but you know, left in Galton.
We had people like Lippmann and Bernays who recognized that people were inherently irrational. And instead of trying to teach them critical thinking, they say, let's use fear and confusion to control them even
That's
more.
That's Spinoza as the author of that. Get a hold of, they're around, a translation of Tractatus Religico Politicus, published in 1690, and any outlook you have on Spinoza will change radically. You're in the hands of a man who could put Adolf Hitler and his high command in the shade. He had worked out all the ways. There weren't any escape loopholes, and he sold the plan to monarchs, you know, who had a long, hard slug to sell it to, you know, the traditional upper classes who still had scraps of morality, traditional morality. They still hadn't become justified sinners. Thomas Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, he's trying to assemble, because Spinoza's ideas are already in America, so he's trying to assemble the possible good use that could come out of an institution of schooling. That's why shallow teacher college texts said that Jefferson was one of the pioneers. But what Jefferson said was that unless five things are done, it will be a mere secular religion. And as soon as I saw it, that's Spinoza's direct positive program to get rid of emotional religion. That's a wild card. Secular religion's okay. I mean, that's what the Church of England is. Wasn't inspired. Men sat around in committees and figured out what God would want.
We have 1 minute left on this tape for today. My question would be, in the last minute, who was Niccolo Machiavelli, and why should every school child take a gander at what
Niccolo... You've got to take a gander at Machiavelli. Machiavelli was a Florentine at a time when Italy wasn't a unified nation. It was a collection of powerful city-states, or at least some were, and Florence was one of the most powerful, but it had important rivals. And Machiavelli, he was a middle-level politician, call him. And he was ambitious. So he wanted to, it was the famous Borgia family.
Cesare Borgia and Medici family.
Yeah. He wanted to do what Henry Kissinger did, is to establish himself as a fountain of utility for the Borgias. And he really had an excellent mind, and it's hard to tell what his character was, because he has other books that are rather morally grounded. But for the first time in history, the secrets that have been talked about in drawing rooms maybe leaked a little bit, like Hobbes' Leviathan there. Suddenly it was an unbroken presentation of how the prince should maintain and enlarge his power there. It electrified the planet. First of all, the people who already knew these things were ticked. And the people who suspected them for putting a moral quandary, a bind. Now it would be a deliberate choice. But for the great unwashed and for the religious power that represented them, here was, and his name was, after all, Nick. Here was old Nick saying here. You know, we could give us 10 years and no one could pass through school without being aware of these high or low points in the creation of their own society. Then at least they would have choices. And I know some would choose to sell out.
But others, because of that that romantic quality in the young, you know, that's why we send them over to get blown up, you know, would they do what they did in the 60s. It's a turning point in American history. After national policy.
Is that tape end? Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to turn the lights off. You can continue talking. I'll just mark where we are.
Oh, I know. This probably ought to be on. But remind me tomorrow, I'll do this. After national policy was contradicted by the riffraff in colleges and high schools, word went out that was never to happen again. A group called the Trilateral Commission published a book they subsidized at NYU. It's worth picking up. It's called The Crisis of Democracy, 1975. And in shorthand, the crisis is, if the people take it seriously, we've got trouble on our hands. So we've got to hide power and how decisions are made even more rigorously than they've done in the past. Just like Hobbes said, power is never where it seems to be. Not us, it's never there. Those are always the, you know, the black catcher.
If only Hobbes was writing for the average person, if only the person was literate, if only they had critical thinking so that when they were so that their literacy didn't make them a slave.
Yeah, or make them think of people like Hobbes. Oh, it's just another book. It's a man's book. Yeah. That's his opinion. Well, he was the advisor of the king, and the book stayed in print, you know, for 450 years.
It's actually in the great book set. It's in with Machiavelli. Machiavelli and Hobbes, in volume 23. From that set over there.
The Harvard Classic thing.
It's the great books of the Western world.
Oh, yeah.
Put together by
Chicago. I was accepted to the University of Chicago when I was a sophomore in high school, and my mother wouldn't let me go. And my uncle graduated from there.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution. I do apologize for that poor audio quality at the end of that clip, but the tapes had run out and we were running on backup audio at that point. So I think that whatever we're able to glean from those last few words of hour three, I think there's a lot of potency and power in what he was talking about. You just have to focus and listen through the air conditioner as it comes on when we're turning on the lights, etc. But what he's describing in this last part of the third hour, in my opinion, is proofs of a conspiracy, historical evidence and artifacts through time leading us to this revelation that there are predators. We as human beings have natural predators. These predators are organized. They have plans. They even print books on how to manage we the people, whether it's through Spinoza advising these kings how to create a system of slavery for which there's no way out, or it's Machiavelli trying to push up to the Borgia family because they're the new people in power and they had just bought themselves a pope ship and they're in control of the big ship. So he wants to make himself a fountain of utility to this new ruling power, much the same as Henry Kissinger has done through the past 60 years.
Well, and according to Machiavelli's wiki page, I haven't researched it further than that, it reads that Machiavelli was, quote, taught grammar, rhetoric. He had a, quote, renowned Latin teacher and became a magnificent writer.
just to interrupt you and mention that from before when we were talking about Martin Luther, one of the notes that I had that I didn't read while John was pausing and trying to think of every man his own priest, the footnote that I added in there is to the effect that how did Martin Luther come to these observations and these epiphanies that changed so many people's lives? So I looked into his education, and ironically enough, Martin Luther was trained in grammar, logic, and rhetoric, the classical arts of the trivium. And if you research a paper in the episode notes authored by Webster Tarpley on the Venetian nobility, you'll see that the Venetian black nobility, who were an association of merchants and bankers, had funded Martin Luther. And there's also ties to the Rosicrucians. So the whole phenomenon that is Martin Luther, every man his own priest, which is a very anti-establishment message, quite possibly, if you follow the artifacts, was funded as a countermeasure by somebody or some group or some group of groups that stood to benefit from taking away the power from the traditional establishment and transferring it to a more, let us say, tyrannical new establishment.
Well, my comments are brief. Essentially, I think, yeah, people would need to understand the Malthusian idea of scarcity or artificial scarcity so that they stop buying into a lot of these philosophies today that serve to fill you full of fear and, you know, make you think overpopulation and lack of food and all these things are realities and that requires a massive population reduction. Gatto mentioned, you know, Bernays and Lippmann and Spinoza and the various histories of those guys in terms of developing psychological warfare and propaganda and just ways to put our minds in ever complex prisons that are in, you know, for the most part, invisible to us if we don't have critical thinking. And this, yeah, moving away from religion is really like a three-card Monty thing. They're really pushing you from one belief system to another. Any belief system that requires you to suspend your critical thinking abilities is essentially asking you to give your power away to it. And so just recognizing that as a pattern that is applied in all kinds of areas in people's lives and throughout the system and any authoritative force, I think is a good thing to see. And then, yeah, studying Machiavelli and even the fact that there is this, what do you want to call it, a philosophy or an operating system or an ideology, but that people who are, you know, if I'm smart enough to figure out how to take over the world, I deserve to be able to take over the world is a retroactive rationalization of the ends justify the means. And it doesn't make it any more ethical or morally correct. So, you know, people just have to, I guess, in the end, realize that if they understand who's driving the corporate ships, who's created them, what they need to continue operating them, the corporate ships operate in a sea of our ignorance. And so all we need to do is dry up that sea of ignorance by learning critical thinking, and their ships will flop over and be unable to move on dry land.
Do you mean that literally, or is that a metaphor?
I'll let the audience decide at this point. I think they've heard enough that maybe they've practiced some critical thinking and they can decide for themselves whether that's, or, you know, what that is to them, what it means to them.
Touche.
One thing that Gatto mentioned throughout this last segment here kind of showcases Gatto's brilliance in the fact that the way he describes Benjamin Franklin in his autobiography, first he describes, of course, Benjamin Franklin as the ultimate pragmatist, and he always found a way to morally justify whatever tightrope he might be walking politically or philosophically or whatever he might be doing. And he was of such ambiguous moral character that his own son stopped communicating with him after so much time. So that was interesting. I believe he comes from kind of a humble family, a candlemaker's family, not a major. It's not like the Wedgwood pottery family from which Darwin originates. It's a much more humble background. Nonetheless, one of the things I love about Gatto is how he's able to introduce this concept. You read between the lines and get that underlying connotation of what's mentioned in the autobiography. What Gatto's pointing out is this kind of a form of open source education whereby he allowed, or his family allowed, different members to come in from the community and share their perspective on life and their work and their job.
You know, I was just looking for a documentary that I was watching this morning that somebody had sent me, And right out of the gate, it was all of this scarcity and fear and, you know, this guy saying that this was going to be the last generation and there was nothing for his children and just on and on and on. And I was trying to find the name of the documentary because it's such a perfect example of this type of fear mongering and pushing these ideas of scarcity for the upper elite. It's just so pertinent to our conversation and such a prime example of this type of thing. But now I can't find what I've done with it.
Well, look for it while Kevin reads his reference.
I really appreciated your metaphor there of the corporate ships, because the Rockefeller boards, they themselves were likened to a fleet of ships with the Rockefeller Foundation at the lead, until they were consolidated with the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Memorial and the others. What I really felt that Gatto was doing in that last 15 minutes or so was giving illustrations or evidences of the extension of childhood. He brought up Edison, he brought up Ben Franklin, and he showed how these people were able to rise to prominence by recognizing what it was that really was the ruling force. And that was the rhetoric of the time and the ability to produce mass media to reach large groups of people. And that was just early forms of leverage. And he mentioned him as the ultimate pragmatist. I found, of course, we all kind of in the room, you can hear us kind of sigh and nod in affirmation when he mentions the Trilateral Commission and how they were being employed as a stabilizing force to the idea that people might be taking democracy too seriously. And that's really what I took from that section. I think this provides a really good illustration, whereas, you know, of course, Ben Franklin was not by any means necessarily a good person, and Edison as well with what he did to Tesla. But you can see how these independent livelihoods produce independent systems of value that have affected our lives in much greater ways than John Doe, Ph.D.
Well, let me just be clear that I'm not idolizing Ben Franklin. The purpose of my asking him that question is I was asking those questions so he could illustrate. He was pointing out that times in the past, curiosity was used as this lever of invention, that there was an entrepreneurial spirit, a self-reliant attitude among young children who were finding their way out in the world. And so by asking a question about Ben Franklin, I wanted him to talk about his work ethic. If we want to talk about the negative side of Ben Franklin as a founding father, we can look into the archaeological digs into the two residences of Ben Franklin, one in London and one in the United States, and both of which had the bodies and skeletons of human beings in the basement. So there's that aspect. There's the aspect that he was a member of multiple secret societies. He was the Grand Master Freemason of the Nine Sisters Lodge in Paris, as well as a Grand Master Freemason in London, England, as well as the United States. And so he's the first guy to print money and do all these other things here in the colonies. I can only assume that there's another side of Ben Franklin who's working on behalf of the British East India Company, but that's for another conversation.
Absolutely. And I think those points were well illustrated. It's not to say that necessarily these were upstanding people in all areas of their lives, but he knows that, you know, Ben Franklin, the story of Ben Franklin is something that is very common and a good meeting point to try to describe these ideas.
And Kevin, lastly, I would just add to what you mentioned a couple minutes ago, the Trilateral Commission, and Gatto brings up of democracy, the report of the governability of democracies to the Trilateral Commission. And the book Trilaterals Over Washington, which was written by Anthony Sutton and Patrick Wood, I think in 1978, would be an excellent book for people to get who wanted to research a little bit more into that.
All right. Now, if I might help to clear this table of notes, he starts out with Ben Franklin. And what I'm picturing in my mind is because they don't have any TV back then, and Ben's father wants young Ben to have a very robust idea of human nature and history itself, he brings men in off the street, people who are professionals, people who are homeless and need food and just need a meal, what have you. So every night of the week, there is a different character sitting at the table telling his life story so that Ben and his brothers might learn from their mistakes before going off into life. So I think that was a very unique and enriching, brings an unknown. It brings a sense of the unknown to dinner. I mean, you know, somebody doesn't handle their wine too well, you could have a fight. If someone has disagreeable political views, they might not like hearing a different side, so on and so forth. So there's this whole almost essence of unknown and mystery and danger that comes along with dinner every night. So that's a fascinating little idea to draw from the autobiography of Ben Franklin. The idea that he and both, you know, Thomas Edison and several other people that we talk about are entrepreneurs at heart, develop a product, and therefore create jobs. Now, this is the use of creativity and curiosity in juxtaposition to our observation of what's going on and inventing solutions to problems that exist. In Ben Franklin's case, it might have even been a contrived problem. He might have just presented the case and said, hey, this is going on, but the guy who's hiring him never checked it out. So then he's got these guys chained to their desk, and they're more productive, and he's making a penny or two every bucket of beer. So that's one type of it. Thomas Edison discovered another type of it. Instead of selling orphans off of trains, he's like, let me just provide some basic needs that people, you know, are into buying and so on and so forth, and just offer it in a different venue. Now you can get your news earlier, you can get your food on the train, et cetera, et cetera. So what John's referring to is our birthright as human beings. And if we have these prospects that are there and we know about them, it leads to our freedom. But we went through the public school system, so we were built in with fear and submission. So at age 12, I'm concerned about, like, not getting beat up. I'm concerned with getting good grades, et cetera, low self-esteem, because it's all provisional self-esteem by the school system, right? And what John's noting is that back at the turn of the century and 17th century, 18th century, up to the 20th century, but not making it into the 20th century, was this whole idea of inventiveness. And he cites several times through the interview how many inventions America was producing versus the rest of the world and how we were dealing with problems. And if you look at the curve of America's success, it has everything to do with curiosity and inventiveness, the things that specifically were removed by Prussian education. So the Prussian education system is denying us of our birthright. And this, in John's words, is a colossal crime so far beyond what we define as good and evil, because it's so far outside of our understanding or perspective or limitations of what human beings can do. Now we find out that there are monsters among us who have philosophically justified themselves to do anything they want. They have irrationally justified their insanity. And so this is the moral mountain that Malthus is talking about. It's a kindness to hasten their demise. That being we, the 99% of the people on this planet. It's a great kindness. They're doing God's work. And I think John's being more than a little bit sarcastic there, though the people who are actually doing this literally believe this.
They've convinced themselves.
And then I refer to Lippmann and Bernays because they're more recent in history. And so I thought of them as really in the 20th century being the chief progenitors behind this use of fear and driving people's innate irrationality, but it's not innate irrationality. It's contrivedly grown by the public school system, and that Lippmann and Bernays were using this contrivance of irrationality against people instead of trying to teach them how to reason their ways out of this. And John brings back to my attention, that's not Lippmann and Bernays, that's Spinoza. They're following a philosophy already set down and proven through time to be effective at maintaining and controlling people. So what he's referring to is Baruch or Benedict Spinoza in Holland with his Tractatus Religico-Politicus. It's all the ways to manage slaves, and he sold this plan to the monarchs, right? He then brings you back across the ocean to Thomas Jefferson, and Jefferson saying, if we don't do these five things, we're going to end up with a Spinozan-like education system. And there's also, if I might digress for a second, there's also Thomas Jefferson's opinion on the Bavarian Illuminati. What was that, Kevin?
Well, when asked, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but when asked about Adam Weishaupt, Thomas Jefferson was getting all kinds of letters from Jedediah Morris as well as many of the other religious leaders up in New England because there was a Bavarian scare going on. And so eventually Thomas Jefferson had been asked what he thought of Adam Weishaupt, and he said that he found him to be a fine philanthropist. Yeah, I'll have to find that quote to make this work out. I'm sorry.
I think it's that's in Terry Melanson's Perfectibilists.
It is, but I actually found it. I found it
other places.
Yeah, you know, Thomas Jefferson exercise or whatever it was. But yeah, we'll have to fix that. Sorry about that.
That's fine. I don't have it'll be in the show notes. You know, this is a real show. We're just kind of feeling it out as we listen to it ourselves and compare notes. So I would also mention the letters between Reverend George Washington Snyder and our first president, George Washington, October 24th, 1789, wherein George Washington, in his own handwriting, these are on file at the Library of Congress, says that I have received the book Proofs of a Conspiracy by John Robison, who is a Scottish physicist and a fellow of the Royal Society, who was a Freemason and defected, and said that there is this group called the Bavarian Illuminati, that they have infiltrated all the Freemasonry lodges. Here's their methods. Here's their means. He offered the evidence. George Washington read this book. It was sent to him, 1789. He comments on it in more than one letter. So the myth that the Illuminati is this nebulous, doesn't exist, conspiracy theory type of thing is exactly that. It's a nebulous assertion.
The Frank Albo theory that the Illuminati was doing all good and that they brought on the best education system ever?
Yeah, I didn't think that highly of Frank Albo's work, but I'm sure if you only read their side, you could be convinced that they were doing things to better people and better society. But when you look at their actions through time and what they've undermined as far as the potential of billions of people around the world by creating a Prussian education system to specifically dumb us down, to create an information gap, which is a knowledge gap, which is a power gap, which is the gap between slaves and masters. And I don't want to be a slave, and I don't want to be a master. I want to be a sovereign. I want to be an individual who is autonomous, who is surrounded by other free-thinking, reasonable, logical, autonomous, sovereign beings. That was the original intention in the creation of America, that we were all sovereigns, that we were neither master nor slave, that we were neither king nor subject. We were our own integrity of a person. But that's been taken away through numerous legal measures, and it's all done through words, how they remove our humanity from us bit by bit through laws, which are artificial limitations put on you by an authority, but any law is subject to your consent. And that's the basis behind law. Government as well. It's all based on your consent.
And what Thomas Jefferson said was, Weishaupt seems to be an enthusiastic philanthropist. He is among those, as you know, the excellent Price and Priestley, Richard Price and Joseph Priestley, who believe in the indefinite perfectibility of man.
So after Jefferson, we then talk about Machiavelli, who was a political mastermind, a strategic mastermind for the Medici banking family. Now, if you're on Netflix, there's a great documentary called Empires, the Medici banking family, or something to that effect. It'll give you the history of the Medici family in Italy. Machiavelli worked for the Medici family until he found out there was a more powerful family in Italy. It was the Borgia crime family that had recently bought themselves a papal seat in the Vatican. And so after the Borgias go over and they do this sort of political undermining in Florence, then Machiavelli then tries to make himself a fountain of utility to this new crime family that's in control. And so if you are interested in reading about Machiavelli, which is the last thing we talk about in the interview for the third hour, I would highly recommend seeking out the Showtime miniseries titled The Borgias. Because if you watch the miniseries, you'll have a much easier time. It actually will put handles on Machiavelli's work. So when you read The Prince, you'll actually understand the people that are being talked about, the character, their nature. I think the Borgias miniseries is an excellent representation and builds a ramp such that anybody who is able to read and have an adult level of thinking and cognition can get what's actually being communicated through The Prince, which is this secret of conspiracy, this secret of how power is actually gained, maintained, and expanded through time. And it had existed and was a secret held among people who were able to consult kings and make these sort of things happen. But all of a sudden, now it's out there in print. It's out there in book form, where people who aren't the managerial class can now get a handbook of the tactics that are being used against them. And so in this book, really what Machiavelli is doing, whether it is nationally or on purpose, is he's providing choice to people, because now he's saying this thing exists. The idea of conspiracy, it's not a theory. Conspiracy theory is a phrase thrown around by people who have not read their history, who do not know themselves, and have not taken the time to do anything more than take a shortcut to thinking. So when you're called a conspiracy theorist, understand that you're interacting with somebody who really hasn't taken time to look around and see what's going on. And you should have, should take kindness toward them. You should feel a little empathy, because these people are basically asking you for help. And you have to become a teacher You can't be in a defensive position when somebody says that to you. You have to say, oh, in so many words, you poor soul, you have been deprived of your birthright. You think this place is all based on coincidences. In reality, we as human beings have predators. These predators have created proxies called corporations and government and foundations and nonprofits and et cetera, et cetera. Whether it's ecological geoengineering or it's a genetic modification of our foods or ourselves, these are all forms of eugenics as thought up by Galton and Darwin and all their progenitors who followed their philosophies afterwards. But the point is, for the first time in history, we now have these secrets unbroken in a presentation of how people gain and maintain and enlarge their power over we, individual human beings. And at the end of the tape, when John describes Machiavelli as Old Nick is a colloquial term for the devil. He's seen as the devil by the establishment because they're like, why the hell would you tell people how we manage them? It's the same thing that Aristotle was told by Alexander when Alexander the Great said, hey, why are you printing these books that tells people how we manage them? It's the same thing. So Machiavelli is seen by us as this guy who wrote this plan to tell princes how to maintain their principalities, and yet by the elite, they hate him too. So it's like he's got this special place reserved in hell for people who don't appreciate the true cause and effect of somebody putting in writing a plan that we can see and say, yeah, they use this. This is their MO. This is their modus operandi. So in this warfare that is our national policy against our indigenous people, citizens of this nation, and people external to this nation where we try to bring them democracy through force, fraud, and coercion, Gatto brings it home by observing that in the 60s, when people were expanding their consciousness, whether it was from MKUltra releasing LSD or people just having natural experiences getting to know themselves, you have this robust uprising against the authority. And this is the crisis of democracy. And specifically in the 1970s, the Trilateral Commission was the newest function of the Cecil Rhodes Tragedy and Hope Roundtable that's all described by Carol Quigley. And the Trilateral Commission is there to manage an international crisis of democracy. Now, notably enough, one of the founders of the Trilateral Commission was this guy named Zbigniew Brzezinski. And he was the advisor to current President Barack Obama, and still is, to my knowledge. But we'll have to save that for next hour. So to close down this third hour, the ultimate history lesson, I will quote Thomas Hobbes in his book, Leviathan. Power is never where it seems to be. And that is the lesson that we don't learn in public education. We don't learn that in public schooling. And that is the lesson that this episode specifically is intended to teach. So until next time, I'd like to thank Paul, Kevin, Lisa, Jan, and Tony for helping me to bring this interview with John Taylor Gatto even more to life. Because it's not just in hearing his words that brings us to reality. It's in understanding the context, and it's understanding the deeper messages of what he's saying that brings it into a useful reality. So until next time, I'd like to thank you for participating in Tragedy and Hope and Peace Revolution, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out. All right, that's a wrap.
Call me a master of war. You that failed all the guns, you that failed the death blades, you that failed all the bonds, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind this. I just want you to know and can see through your mask. You that never done nothing but failed to destroy, or you play with that world like it was your.
You put a gun in my head, then you hide from my eyes. Then you turn and run farther when the past is by. Like Jesus, oh, you lie at the sea. I will walk and be warned. You want us to believe, but I see through your eyes and I see through your brain, like I see. That passing all the truth for the others to find, and you sit back and watch as a death count gets high. You hide in white mansions while young people's blood goes out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. Could ever be heard up here to bring children into this world for threatening my baby just born in your state. You can't work the blood that runs through your turn. You might say that I'm yours. You might say I'm on the blur. Well, there's one thing I'm yours, though I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you. Ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it would? Well, I think you will burn when your death takes its toll. All our money soon. I will follow your casket in the pale afternoon, and I'll watch as you learn. And to your deathbed, and I'll stand over your grave.
Thank you.